the meeting of the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission to order. It's January 27th at approximately 2:30 in the p.m. We're here in the State Capitol Building. I'm Commissioner Dusty Johnson. With me are Commissioner Steve Kolbeck and Gary Hansen. Our first order of business today will be approval of the minutes of the commission meetings for November 25th and December 9th, as well as an ad hoc meeting held on December 16th. The amendments have been circulated. Are there any amendments or corrections? Hearing none, is there a motion?
Move for approval.
Motion for approval has been made on all 3 minutes. No second is necessary. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Vote Hansen.
Aye.
Kolbeck.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Second item on our agenda is consumer reports, and we'll look to Ms. Gregg for an update.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. The Commission has received a total of 179 contacts since the last report was prepared for the December 30th, 2008 Commission meeting. 50 of the contacts involved telecommunication services, 33 contacts involved electric service, 26 contacts involved natural gas service, 2 contacts involved gas and electric services, 12 contacts involved cell phone service, 21 contacts related to the Do Not Call registry, 3 contacts involved wind energy, 3 contacts related to the Keystone Pipeline, 1 contact involved the grain warehouse, and 28 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 2,500 of the 2,513 complaints received in 2008 have been resolved, and 117 of the 145 complaints received thus far in 2009 have been resolved.
Thank you, Ms. Gregg. Any questions for Ms. Gregg? Thanks. Next item on the agenda is consumer complaints number one, specifically CT08-002. This deals with a complaint by Mr. Roger Hall of Rapid City against Quest Corporation. It deals with the cost of telephone line extensions. Today was originally scheduled for to hear any testimony on pre-hearing motions. We do have one such motion. Specifically, how shall the commission proceed regarding the procedural schedule? That motion was made by Quest. Does anybody for Quest want to speak to that filing?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, this is Colleen Siebold for Quest. Our attorney, George Thompson, filed a motion to adjust the procedural schedule, and we did email a copy of that to Mr. Hall. Mr. Thompson was required to be before the Iowa Utilities Board today on another matter, and a statutory requirement mandated that the hearing be today, so it was unavoidable. Mr. Thompson has offered that we would be agreeable to working on another date for a possible ad hoc. Otherwise, he suggested the February 24th scheduled meeting. I'd just like to restate that it was through no fault of Mr. Thompson. He just absolutely could not be here. So we've requested it to be rescheduled.
Thank you, Ms. Seifold. Mr. Hall?
Thank you. This is much better than last time I was here. We were hot and under remodel. I guess I'd like to just state that I think we should move forward to the hearing. I understand it's my intention, or it's Quest's intention, to file for a summary judgment, and I think we need to move forward to a hearing at this time. We've had plenty of time. Discovery ended at the end of the year, so we're awaiting response to discovery questions, obviously, at this time. But I would like to see us move forward. This has been going on in my life for 3 years now, so it's starting to drag on. That's all I have to say for that. Thank you.
We'll look to staff for their analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. This is Kara Semler for staff. We have discussed some possible hearing dates, and the earliest hearing date would be March. With that being said, I don't see any harm in delaying this opportunity to file a summary judgment motion. We can't hold a hearing until March anyway, and a summary judgment motion can be an efficient way to deal with some or all of the issues involved. It could make for a more efficient hearing if we do get there. So I don't see a harm in a delay and an opportunity for Quest to file a motion for summary judgment.
Thank you. Questions by commissioners or advisors for any party? Mr. Hall, if you would. And I didn't know that you all were looking at potential March dates. I mean, if March is when a hearing would happen anyway, is there a reason we couldn't hear some, you know, preliminary motions by any of the parties in February?
You know, as I've stated before, I'm not fully aware of the legal system and how this whole thing works. And I don't know what my part would be completely. If he files for a summary judgment, I mean, do I come back down here to speak to you guys again, or do I have to respond in writing? And at that point, I'm still going to ask that we go to a hearing so that we can hear the facts of the case and disclose all the issues, you know. And I'll say the thing that's on the agenda is a little bit of a misnomer. It says extension of lines to my property. That's part of the issue. The bigger issue in my mind is the requirement for me to upgrade their system in a town that is growing at a steady 6% per year. That's my heartburn. It's not the extension of the lines of my property. It's the upgrading of their system to handle capacity. So at this point, I would really like, you know, I don't want to keep filing delays and delays and delays. You know, we were here last summer. Here we are again in the winter. You know, and it's wearing on me quite a bit. I've got 9 people living there now, and I want to get them phone service the most efficient way possible. So I guess I would object to allowing them to file summary judgments. We had plenty of time. We agreed to this schedule at our last meeting, and that's what I want to stick with and move forward to a hearing. So,
thanks, Mr. Hall. Other questions? Hearing none, we'll close the discussion or action.
I think we can wait with this item. I think obviously if we take it up in February, we're still on the March deadline. I know that Quest Attorney has filed, but he is not here today. I guess I'd ask the commissioners if deferral until another date is sufficient with them.
Well, I think we've got a couple of things going on. We've got the one filing that Quest did make, and I think they're making that filing in order for them to be able to make a second filing, a motion for summary judgment. So, you know, we kind of have two different things going on here, the one filing they've made and the one they want to make.
I'm sorry.
I want to clarify, too, we haven't secured that March hearing date. It's been talked about, so I don't want to mislead you to think that it's been set and everyone's confirmed that date. So I apologize if I did mislead you on that date. Okay. We're working on it.
Mr. Chairman, are you looking for a motion on deferral then? From my standpoint, it's obvious that Quest really did not have the option here. There's a law requiring them to attend a hearing or another event. They simply can't attend this one, notwithstanding if we had a law requiring them to attend this one. But certainly I can understand the challenge that they were faced with, and I certainly understand the frustration of going through this. It's been extended for a long period of time. We need to get it accomplished, but through no fault of their own, one of the parties can't attend, so it's not fair to jump right into it. Are you looking for a motion on deferral on that one item at this juncture?
Well, I think what Quest would want, and at least at this point what I'm leaning toward, is granting their motion to adjust the schedule, which sort of allows us, as Commissioner Kolbeck said, to sort of defer taking action on any other major motions they might have or motions for summary judgment. You know, like you, Commissioner Hansen, I sympathize rather greatly with Mr. Hall. These things often take a lot longer than we like, but that being said, it sounds like March is probably the best we can expect for go time anyway.
Does staff offer a date when they believe that this can be accomplished?
I believe it makes sense to go with the February 24th date as was proposed by Quest. It's a regular meeting date, and we're all scheduled to be here. I believe that date would work for a to hear a summary judgment motion by Quest, and March 10th is a day specifically we're hoping to coordinate a hearing. If not, we'll look into, you know, April and May.
Does that date work for all the parties?
This is Colleen from Quest, and that date was just proposed to me a little bit ago, and because Mr. Thompson's in a hearing, I've not been able to get a hold of him. But as soon as I can confirm with him, I would let the commission know.
Well, we'd really like to get it nailed down here for all of the parties. Please, Ms. Hall. If I may, Mr. Chairman.
I met with your people earlier, and we kind of came up with those dates. My schedule's fairly flexible. I guess my question would be is if they do file for a motion for summary judgment, and that if that motion's denied or whatever, can we move right into a hearing at that time, or is that the way that works?
You know, I'll take a stab at it, and you know, the attorneys will correct me, or my colleagues will. You know, no, you really want all the parties to prepare for the question at hand, and so you know, everybody's sort of focused on you know the first round playoff game versus X, and then if you win that game, or you know, then you prepare for sort of the next round. So if Quest were to file for motion of summary judgment, the commission were to agree with you that their motion is not appropriate, then I think we'd still be looking at possibly March 10th or some other dates to have the whole full hearing. And obviously we love having you here. I mean, we're impressed that you're willing to come. You know, something like a preliminary motion, you could certainly come to Pierre if you wanted to. Participation telephonically is not unusual.
I've tied this in with another thing, so yeah. I had to come down for legislature. So.
Yeah. Well, we do. Frankly, we're not normally this popular, so it's nice to see this many faces in the audience. Yeah. Other comments or questions?
I have maybe a comment, if I might. I notice we've tended to totally focus on motion for summary disposition because Quest specifically referenced that. If you look at the actual schedule item, that was any pre-hearing motions that either party may want to make, and you may want to make one. You know, I don't know, but you might. And if you look at the actual prayer for relief in Quest motion today that's pending, it is just to postpone the hearing until a subsequent date, and the suggested date is February 24th.
You know, as I think has been mentioned, you know, by all three of us, approving Quest motion today doesn't endanger a potential March hearing date. So I don't see any problem with approving the pending Quest filing. And so with that, I'll move that the commission approve Quest's request for an amended procedural schedule. Motion having been made, is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks, Mr. Hall. Yep. First item up for electric is EL08-001. This deals with a permit to construct 115 kV transmission line and other associated modifications. The question for the commission today is, shall it approve the joint motion for approval of stipulation? And additionally, shall the commission approve the construction permit? Do either of the parties, we may have had interveners, but do either staff or Excel have any comments to make with regard to the joint motion?
This is Pam Rasmussen for Excel. I just have one comment to make. I appreciate the time staff and commissioners have put in to support our request for extension of this project. It has taken over a year for the process, which is normally 6 months. And I did want to thank you for your understanding for our need to address route and finalize some routing issues for the project. And note, while it did take a year, that was not due to staff's efforts to move the project forward. And again, we do appreciate that. Other than that, we are in support of the stipulation and have had no major issues working with this project and have enjoyed working with you guys on all these projects in the last few years. Thank you.
Now that my microphone is on, I would conclude by saying that...
Sorry, Jim.
No, it's my fault. My fault. But we just ask for the commissioner to approve this. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks, Mr. Wilcox. Staff.
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. Staff would recommend that the commission grant the joint motion for approval of the stipulation, that the stipulation be adopted without modification, and that the commission approve the permit to construct.
Thanks. Now that I review, I don't believe we had any formal interveners, but does any interested person, or maybe Bob Hill, Brookings County? Okay. Any other person want to make any comments? We'll open to commissioner advisor questions for any party.
Mr. Chairman, just a curiosity, Jim. Can you? I suppose I could have asked this any number of times in the halls when I've run into you, but do you have any idea, 115 kV transmission line from Brookings County to Minnesota, what the maximum amount of megawatts of wind energy that might be capable of carrying?
I'm going to have to defer to Pam here. Pam, can you help with that?
When we've been working on this project, we haven't specifically highlighted the capability of that line with the overall megawatt it carries across the system. It's been a joint analysis in addition to some other lines that we put on the system. This gets up to about 1,200 megawatts of outlet capability off of Buffalo Ridge in combination with the other projects. But I can check with our planners and see if we can get a general number about this project on its own, what it contributes, and get back to you on that.
Would about 350 megawatts be approximately what the maximum? Do you have any idea?
I think the difficulty in giving a direct answer.
30 degrees temperature under the.
is not so much related to the carrying capacity of that specific line itself, but rather the other lines that are in parallel with it. And so it's a dynamic thing that changes over time as well. So, but I think there is probably a carrying capability of this line when it goes into service that we can find that number for.
I appreciate you. Knowing that, if you would. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
For Xcel, it appeared in the stipulation there were a couple of landowners with whom agreement still hasn't been reached. Is that expected to take a lot longer? And I don't need to know a whole lot of specifics, but just in general, what keeps those kind of agreements from happening in maybe a more timely fashion?
Again, I'm defer to Pam.
Yes, thank you for the question. Those landowners have wanted to wait until we got the final route permit from the commission before they were ready to start finalizing negotiations with them. So once we have the final construction permit in hand, we'll go back and contact them and provide them those documents and continue negotiations. But it's our plan to start construction of this project later on this spring for in-service by November. And as we work with those landowners, we can still start construction of the remainder of the project while we're still trying to work out issues with them. So we expect we should get to resolution on the issues with them.
So Ms. Rasmussen, this is Commissioner Johnson again. So it's not as though those landowners have indicated some objection to any particular component of your application or your proposed project. It is more of a procedural thing. They want us to say yes before they do?
Yes, they would like us to say have your okay on the project before they proceed, and then it's a primarily a matter of negotiation over easement and the price for the easement.
Sure, okay. Yeah, and I just want to make sure the issues they were concerned about, that those issues weren't something the commission had broad discretion over. I mean, obviously compensation is not a statutorily granted power of the commission in this sort of a siting proceeding. So thanks. Other questions? I'll have one for Ms. Kramer. Ms. Kramer, does this stipulation differ in any substantive ways compared to others we've had with transmission lines in the recent past?
It does not. In fact, the last few we really have gotten down almost to a boilerplate, but for the description, the cost of the project and that, but, you know, those sorts of things. But we worked very hard to make them very uniform.
Which I do think is good. I mean, aside from giving, the public and commissioners a higher sense of comfort, it's also nice because it gives those who are looking to build transmission lines a pretty firm idea of what issues the commission thinks are important. So, great. Other questions? Hearing none, any discussion or action? Go ahead, Commissioner.
You go ahead.
I was just going to mention to Ms. Rasmussen, I very much appreciated your comments about that the delay was not caused to, you know, there are any sort of problems in dealing with staff. You know, we never really know when something takes, you know, 6 months or a year or longer to get done. We're not quite sure what the holdup is as individual commissioners. And so we do appreciate your kind words about staff and providing us that context.
You're welcome.
I was just going to echo that. Thank you to Xcel for reacting in a professional manner and bringing more transmission to the state of South Dakota. I know that's a huge hot topic right now. And with that, I'll motion to approve in EL08-001, approve the joint motion for approval of the stipulation. And the should we do that in separate motion to approve the commission construction permit or all in one?
I think it could be both two. Okay. I mean, you could do them together.
Okay. So, yeah, approve the joint motion for approval of motion for approval of stipulation and the commission approve the construction permit.
Motion has been made. Discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chairman, I believe this transmission docket was brought to us January 31st of 2008. And it being January 30th of 2009, it took South Dakota less than 1 year to approve a transmission line. I just thought that's interesting.
I wasn't initially sure where you were going with that, but I think I figured it out by the end. I do, Commissioner Kolbeck, I know there's a pending motion, but if with your allowance, I'd ask a question.
Yes.
Okay. With some construction projects in the past, there have been some issues raised with debris. I mean, do we feel, Ms. Kramer, like, you know, this current stipulation addresses debris significantly enough?
Are you talking about, like, the garbage they leave day to day, that sort of?
Or even after construction is completed, if there still might be bits of construction debris left behind?
I believe we did address that, similar to what we've done in all the others. Reseeding, things like that. I can look quickly if you would like.
Well, and I do think stipulations in the past have addressed them. I just in specifically want to know if we made any tweaks to them. I know there weren't any big picture changes, but...
Mr. Knadel or Ms. Rasmussen, do you remember, I don't believe we have the restoration revegetation as we have in the past, the site disposal, the waste disposal. I don't believe we changed that much of all, at all.
Great, thanks very much. With that, we do have a pending motion on the floor. Thanks, Commissioner Kolbeck, for your flexibility. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson.
Aye.
Kolbeck.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thank you.
Did you stop your stopwatch?
Thank you, Commissioners.
All right. Electric item number 2. Deals with consideration of new purpose standards, and specifically today, how shall the commission treat petitions for intervention by parties that have filed? There were a number of petitions for intervention. I think most of them speak for themselves, but we'll pause to see if anyone who did file such a petition wants to say anything. Hearing nothing, we'll turn towards staff, see if they have any comments or any recommendations on those filings.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. This is Kara Semler. Staff recommends commission approval of all petitions to intervene. We appreciate all of the ideas and help on these PURPA dockets. So recommend the petitions be granted.
If Congress continues to pass a massive new energy bill every couple of years, this will be a new line of work on a permanent basis for us. So, and I think, if memory serves, each of the 6 investor-owned utilities filed for intervention, so it's not as though any of them are left on the outside looking in. Okay. Anyone else wish to speak? Hearing none, any questions for any parties?
For staff, I guess everybody that's applied for intervention is online, correct? The 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So this motion would encompass 6 different companies, correct?
Correct. Okay. Correct.
Any other questions? Hearing none, any discussion or action? I will move that we grant intervention to all 6 filed interventions. Motion has been made. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Electricity item number 3 is an application for an energy conversion facility permit for the construction of the Buffalo Ridge 2 wind farm and some other associated facilities. The question before the commission today, there are actually two. We'll take them separately. The first is, shall the commission grant intervention to any parties that may have filed? I believe we have a number, including Dual County Commission, South Dakota Rural Electric Association, Sioux Valley Energy, HD Electric, Brookings County Commission, Ralph Terrell Spence, and Catherine D. Carter. And I don't think any others have come in. And at this point, we'll see if any of those who have filed for intervention have any comments. Ms. Rogers.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the Commission. I represent three of the intervening parties in this docket, SDREA, HD Electric, and Sioux Valley Energy. I just wanted to clarify that we have in the past intervened in these types of actions, and it's certainly not our intention to try to slow down or stop the proceedings here. We have very specific interests, including station power, and that if there's any station power to be purchased, it would be purchased from the incumbent incumbent provider. We are also concerned that any transmission lines would be for wholesale power only and that they not provide service to any consumers. And finally, in this case, there will be places where the proposed Buffalo Ridge 2 collectors lines will intersect with our electric lines, and we just want to make sure that those crossings are completed in a safe and sound and reasonable manner. So those are the reasons for our intervention, and I just wanted to make it clear that we're not trying to slow down the proceedings. We have talked to people from Buffalo Ridge, and we'll be proposing some language, and hopefully we can we'll be able to work out some type of an agreement that we would submit to the Commission for approval. Thank you.
Thank you. Other requested interveners? Hearing none, we'll look to Buffalo Ridge 2 LLC or their parent to see if they have any objection, or whether it has any objection.
Good afternoon, commissioners and staff. Brett Kennecke for the applicant. We note that there are interveners in the docket, and we don't object to any of the interventions. However, I do have to say I appreciate Ms. Rogers' comments. These are short dockets, as you know, and as you can imagine, I'm a little bit punchy about interveners and citing dockets. I've been on some bad trips with them in the recent past. And so this docket presents novel issues, and it in some ways it presents issues of first impression for the commission, and I really don't want to spend an undue amount of time talking about the territory laws of this state as they might or might not impact this docket. Our client has no territory in which it's authorized to provide electric power to anybody, and we have no intentions of providing it or coming with a Section 56 petition to generate our own power or purchase it elsewhere. So I just want to say publicly, I don't want to spend any more time talking about those issues and would much rather talk about the novel issues in this docket in the remaining time that's left before a decision needs to be rendered. So I appreciate Ms. Rogers' comments very much. We've had several discussions about it, and we don't oppose the other interventions here this afternoon. And we don't oppose those either, to the extent that I misspoke. All interveners are fine.
Thanks, Mr. Kennecke, and I certainly understand your reticence to, discuss issues beyond that which this petition deals with. We'll look to staff. Any comments? Ms. Semler?
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. Kara Semler for staff. Staff does not object to any of the petitions to intervene. With that being said, I would echo Mr. Kennecke's comments. If intervention's required to and allowed to assure that all laws are being followed, that would leave interventions wide open in any docket. Rather, if laws aren't being followed, the proper procedure is to file a complaint. So we don't object. Again, the more ideas and heads we can get together, oftentimes the best solution, the better solution we can find. So no objection, but just wanted to put that hesitation on record.
Well, I'm sure both councils are more aware than I am that the wording of the citing statute as it relates to intervention is broad enough where it's difficult to come up with a legal objection. But your concerns are certainly noted by this commissioner, at least. Other comments? Any questions for commissioners or advisors for any party or petitioner? Hearing none, any discussion or motion?
Mr. Chairman, I will move that the commission grant intervention to all the parties that have filed for intervention.
Motion has been made. No second is required. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0.
I will also grant that the motion for entry of protective order.
Motion has been made. If it's acceptable, Commissioner, could we have the applicant, the petitioner, make a couple of comments about that protective order?
Certainly. I'm curious on one portion of it as well.
Sure. Go ahead.
Thank you, Commissioners. Again, Brett Kennecke for the applicant. This docket has and will require us to file confidential information. As you might recall, the legislature has passed laws in the recent past providing that matters specifically involving cultural resources and artifacts are not to be made publicly available, such that people who hunt for artifacts of prior cultures illegally might be tipped off to the location. That's the only confidential filing that I can think of at this point for this docket, but it should be such that interveners, people who are parties to the docket, are able to access that information. And in order to keep the matter moving, I've asked you to enter a protective order. I am not bound by the form that I provided to the commission. I would certainly be open to having commission counsel draft that in any way the commissioners thought was appropriate. But rather than wait for another month to have someone ask for the cultural information and have to enter into other agreements, especially with this is a six-month docket, I thought it was probably appropriate to have an order filed, and that way we can move forward.
Any parties recently granted party status have any comments? Yes, Mr. Hill. Let's have you go ahead and start over, Mr. Hill, so the internet can hear you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Commissioner. The Brookings County Commission would have problems anytime a entry of protective order is put in place for our county employees, because our mission is to give public knowledge to our citizens in Brookings County. But if it was specifically such as state law for artifact hunters and things like that, we would not have a problem with it. The problem would come in when it comes time, I mean, locations where public documents that I've already had for my hearings, you know, if they try to restrict those by putting confidential markings on documents we've already got in place, it would be extremely hard for us to follow the order. And we do want to follow all the orders put out by the Public Utilities Commission. So that's our concern.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Other parties? Staff?
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. It is typical for the commission to enter such a protective order, and it would be for, as it relates to this docket in front of the Public Utilities Commission. So I support the entry of such an order, whether drafted by Mr. Smith or by the applicant.
Questions for any of the parties? Mr. Smith.
I have one maybe for Mr. Kennecke. You know, just looking at this, at your proposed order, it appears to be one that we've used many times in the past. I'm just curious, and, you know, I read it over, and it looked workable to me. If I remember correctly, this is about the same thing we used in Keystone and some other cases, isn't it?
It is, Commissioner. Mr. Smith. It is substantially similar. However, some of the portions of the Keystone order were not appropriate here, given the timing of the Keystone order last time, after the difficulties which were raised by interveners due to the enormous nature of the confidential filing. As I recall, there were several paragraphs which simply weren't appropriate here.
No, that's true. Those dealing with Homeland Security issues, they're not present here as far as we know at this point. But other than that, it looked to be the standard form that we've used a lot of times.
It is.
And would you agree that one of the provisions of that protective order is that the fact that you file something as confidential under that protective order in no way is an ultimate decision by the commission that we will accept its confidential status? In other words, any party, including Brookings County, is free at any time to come before this commission and request that the commission declare that information not protectable under the order. Is that a fair statement?
Well, yes it is. If you'd like me to repeat it back to you, it would be my understanding, Mr. Smith, that our simple marking of a document or documents as confidential do not constitute an order by the commission, but simply more of a request by the applicant that be treated as confidential. That material would be available then to an intervener, to a party in this docket, and they then could ask for a different treatment to be given those documents by the commission. And in my experience, the commission is able and willing to take those requests and look at them as with the scope that's necessary to achieve a result.
Okay, thank you. One of the reasons I bring that up, I know you bring up the archaeological stuff. That's cut and dried. You know, that's state law, and it's a good law. But we never know what parties might request in discovery or whatever, and if they may request business information, for example, that the company considers confidential or whatever. But there is a procedure, and we've had it work pretty well, for any party to come in here and have the commission make a decision on whether it's entitled under state law to that kind of treatment. And thank you.
Other questions? Hearing none, we'll close to commission discussion or action. And I might just note, and this is a bit of a piggyback on this conversation, but Mr. Held, the commission shares your concerns, and if this is the universe of information that would be filed, you know, everything in that universe would be open to everyone in the public except a relatively narrow band that would be under state law essentially required to be kept confidential. This protective order, the good news is that it allows parties access to that confidential information in a way that they might not have absent such a protective order. And that way, I think it actually helps parties prepare for hearing and flesh out issues. Other discussion or action? We have a pending motion to grant the entry of protective order. Any discussion on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much. We will, if it pleases my colleagues, we will take up Electric 4 at the same time as we take up Natural Gas 1. Both of them deal with a requested approval of tariff revisions by Northwestern. Northwestern.
Yes, this is Jeff Decker with Northwestern Energy. We've made a few small changes to several of our customer letters through this filing. And the changes were made mostly just to clarify some of the information in the letters, hopefully make it a little more readable. In addition to the changes in the letters, we've added a bankruptcy letter. And although bankruptcies have not increased among our customers over the last year, it's important to have this letter in our forms as a standard of communication for customers in this situation. Also, in the gas filing, we made an update to our large customer form. That is our rate 84 and 85 customers. It's just the sheet we use to either sign up that customer or to do an update to their firm gas load. That's the quick summary of the changes we've had. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thanks very much, Mr. Decker. Any interested person? Any comments? And look to staff.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. This is Terry Labrie-Baker with staff.
Staff has reviewed the filing. We have no objections to the proposed changes to the sample forms as filed in both dockets, and we would recommend that the Commission approve the tariff revisions with an effective date of January 15, 2009, as proposed by Northwestern.
Thank you, Ms. LaBrie-Baker. Any questions by commissioners or advisors? Mr. Smith.
I have a couple. Maybe they're not so much questions, Jeff, as their comments, and maybe just a couple of little suggestions I might have. One is on the non-sufficient letter or tariff page.
Okay, sheet number 9?
Yep.
Okay.
I note in the first line it says a non-sufficient payment. Might we want to use the term non-sufficient funds to parrot the normal acronym of NSF? And is that what we're trying to get at there, is a non-sufficient funds check payment?
That's right.
Might we want to insert the word funds in there?
Sure, that would be fine.
And I notice this is an ultra nit, but down in toward the end of the next paragraph, you've got a series grammatical construction there. It's cash, money order, cashier's check. Might the word or be properly put in between money order and cashier's check?
Okay. And the version I'm looking at, that is there. The word or is between money order and cashier's check.
Okay.
We filed that. It was either late last week. I think it was late last week we filed that change.
Okay, I missed that. The version I have doesn't have that in it. And just one last question I've gotten, this is probably a dumb one, but is the term return payment in sheet number 6, is that a normally, I guess that's just a phrase I'm not familiar with. Is that a phrase that's a commonly used phrase in collections?
Hey, where's that showing?
That's on the top. It's right under dear customer name under the...
I guess I've heard that term used, a return payment. But simply, the money didn't go through, and they returned the check. So.
Is that something then? Okay, and let me ask you this then. In terms of the use of this letter in the past, you haven't had any problems with customers understanding what this is all about?
No, okay. Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Any discussion or action? And we're dealing with both EL08-003 and NG Natural Gas Item 1, which is NG08-014.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead.
I will move in EL08-003 that the Commission approve the tariff revisions.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion on the motion? Commissioner Kolbeck.
Did you say 003 or 033?
I don't recall.
I was thinking it was...
It's number 4, EL08-033. If I said 003, I misspoke.
Okay.
Motion is made. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johns votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Any motion for natural gas item 1?
I'm motion in NG08-014 that the Commission approve the tariff revisions.
Motion has been made. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0.
All right. Thanks, Commissioners.
Thanks, Mr. Decker. Electric item number 5 is EL08-034. This deals with a filing by Basin Electric Power Cooperative and their intention to apply for a permit for an energy conversion facility. There are a few questions before the Commission today. First, we should probably deal with the waiver request by Basin. There's a 30-day timeline that we're just on the outside of. So let's pause and hear from Basin at this time.
Thank you, Commissioners. I'm Casey Jacobson here with Basin Electric Power Cooperative. With me, we have our South Dakota Council, Haven Stuck, as well as Chris Miller and Kurt Pearson sitting behind me. Regarding the waiver request, that was done at the request of the staff to accommodate today's scheduled meeting.
And I, you know, my feeling is that that's in statute to sort of protect the petitioner to make things move along quickly. I mean, I don't know that anybody else is really prejudiced with this waiver, but just in case, we should probably pause and see if there is any objection to the waiver request. Hearing none, we'll look to staff.
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. And the 30th day, by my count, would have been January 22nd, so you are just a few days outside. And, again, it was looking like it was going to be difficult to get an ad hoc in before that, and so Basin was kind enough to agree to an extension, a waiver, and staff would recommend granting that.
Any question for any of the parties on this particular item? Hearing none, I'll move that the commission grant the waiver request. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, Hansen?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johns votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, we'll turn our attention to the designation of two things. First, an affected area, and secondly, the local review committee. At this time, Ms. Kramer, I suspect you may have some comments for us.
I do. Thank you very much. Pursuant to SDCL 49-41B-6, the commission shall designate an affected area and a local review committee within 30 days of the filing of the notice of intent. Staff filed Exhibits 1 and 2. Staff Exhibit 1 reflects the potential tribes, school districts, counties, and cities when using different mileage bands. The shaded area on Staff Exhibit 1 is staff's recommendation. That's a 12 miles is what staff was looking at. That is based on the economic impact due to 30 permanent employees and the anticipated impact on Brookings, which is the largest city in that area of the facility. Staff Exhibit 2 is a colored map, which shows the same information. Staff would recommend a 12-mile radius for the affected area. If that is adopted, then the local review committee would consist of the following. For tribes, there would be none. For school districts, there are three. That's Brookings, Dewbrook, and Elkton. There are two counties, Brookings and Dewell, and there are six cities: Astoria, Aurora, Brookings, Bushnell, Elkton, and White.
Thanks, Ms. Kramer. Questions? And I'll kick it off. Each of these entities, if the commission were to approve 12 miles, I mean, each of these entities listed in the grade box would have to send a representative who would participate in this local review committee. Is that right?
Correct. And I believe how these local review committees, the first time they may meet in person, and then after that, I believe they do a lot of their work telephonically. They also hire a consultant who actually gathers the information needed and then puts together the final report, which the committee then approves or disapproves or adds comment to it.
And I understand we've got a special situation with Brookings here and where a workforce may live. I mean, if you set Brookings aside from the equation, 12 miles seems like a long ways for a natural gas turbine. Am I right in that feeling? I mean, if it weren't for Brookings, would we go with something less than 12 miles?
Yeah, if Brookings were 15 miles out, you mean, or if Brookings
or if it was 3 miles.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, let's take Brookings out of the equation, or let's say Brookings is within 3 miles. I mean, would we feel the need to push out the radius all the way out to 12 miles?
Probably not, because what we were hoping, like you said, to capture is when we looked at what was around there, where the 30 permanent employees going to live and have their families, who's going to be most impacted. And by going out 12 miles, we caught Brookings, and we figured they would want to be a part of the process as much as anyone.
Well, and each different generation source is so different, but I'm just thinking about our experience with Groton 1 and Groton 2 peaking plants where, but for the economic impact, even the city of Groton, which is very close to those two facilities, doesn't appear to be particularly affected from any sort of an environmental or development, orderly development, or noise perspective. So 12 miles just seemed like kind of a long ways.
It was larger than the Groton ones, which had three permanent employees. And again, the cost of the facility or the cost of the project and all that, just everything about it was larger. So we went with a larger area.
So when we look at the 12 miles, school districts are kind of a constant from 6 to 12. Counties, you pick up dual, and you pick up a few towns along the way, sort of in each box. I mean, if you're the city of Astoria, I mean, could this create a burden on them? I mean, it's 12 miles away from Astoria. Maybe they don't, I mean, they barely care about this facility. Does it create a burden for them to participate in this local review committee?
I really don't think it would. Like I said, they don't have to even participate in person. A lot of it would be telephonically done. And so when I think a project that big is going into your area, they probably do want their citizens talked to. I think in this case, people do want to be involved and put in their two cents worth.
Thanks very much. And it occurs to me that the chair is in error. We should have heard from the applicant first to see if they have any comments before we open up the Q&A. So.
We agree with staff's recommendation of 12 miles. We think that's appropriate, and we have no issues with that recommendation.
Thanks very much. Other questions? Hearing none, any discussion or action?
Well, I didn't have any questions, but I think in the discussion part of it, just to kind of contribute to that, I hope it's not any burden on Astoria. I mean, even like you say, you said they don't have to be to participate in person. Do they have to participate at all?
You know, the statute says the committee shall consist of. I assume if you would opt not to participate, I don't know that you can be forced to show
sure.
up. But
well, and that's what I was kind of getting at. If they don't have a person
right.
willing or able to go into that, it's not a financial burden or any other type of it will not hold up the law or the plant because someone from Astoria didn't participate.
That would be correct.
Okay. And then I would imagine that the other towns are in the same boat, and it would be good knowledge for them to have, so I would agree with the 12 miles.
And just to be clear, they do bear all their own expenses, the people on the local review committee. I mean, there's no fun to pay mileage or anything
oh, sure.
like that. But again, I don't think that would be a terrible economic burden on anyone.
Okay.
I guess to follow up with that, though, Ms. Kramer, if memory serves, in Big Stone 2, there was, I mean, the commission did allow funds to be expended for at least a consultant, maybe not mileage and,
right.
you know, meeting space, but at least a consultant. For the LRC?
For the consultant in that, there is specific language as to that, but not expenses of the local review committee themselves.
Great. Thanks very much. Other questions? Any discussion or action?
I'm satisfied with the 12 miles. Oh, I'm sorry. The 12 miles, I think, is a good compromise. You have to go a lot more miles to actually increase that number a lot, and I think 6 miles is actually too small. So I'll motion to approve in EL08-034 that the commission designate an affected area of 12 miles. Do we need a different motion to designate the local review committee?
If it's all right with you, let's put them together.
Okay. The commission will designate a local review committee of 12 miles, consisting of the Brookings School District, Dewbrook School District, Elkton School District, the County of Brookings, the County of Dewell, and the cities of Astoria, Aurora, Brookings, Bushnell, Elkton, and White.
Motion has been made. Any discussion on the motion? With that, hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Oh, did you have a comment, Commissioner?
No, I'm prepared to vote.
Johnny on the spot. Hanson.
Aye.
Kolbeck.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioners. We look forward to working with you and the staff in this next year in approval of this project.
We've handled our natural gas portion of the agenda, so we'll proceed to Pipeline Safety 1. PS08-003 deals with the issue involving the pipeline safety staff and Northwestern Energy. The question before the commission today is, shall it approve the settlement agreement and dismiss the docket? We'll look first to staff, Mr. Stoll and Ms. Semler.
Thank you, Commissioner. If you remember, PS07002 was our original pipeline docket that was an investigation that resulted from a pipeline incident in Mitchell. That docket outlined staff's concerns, and staff's report was later amended as we were able to resolve those concerns through meetings with Northwestern Energy. One issue that did remain has now been resolved in the context of this complaint docket. We feel comfortable with the resolution, and I can go into further detail regarding the remaining issue and its resolution if you prefer, but I believe the amended report that staff did file explains our position.
Northwestern.
Thank you, Commissioner Brett Kennecke for Northwestern Energy. The amended report really is the document that tells the whole story here. This is just our settlement agreement to resolve the docket and allow it to be closed at this point. So if there are questions, I'm afraid I don't have that in front of me, but I would refer you back to the amended report. We appreciate staff's efforts in discussing this matter with us, and we look forward to the final resolution of this matter. Thank you.
Questions? Ms. Semler, if you could explain to us a little bit more about the settlement does require that a certain report or sort of guide be prepared and maintained. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. Section 192.615, Section 7 of the federal code we work off for pipeline safety requires that operator's emergency plan must provide for making safe any actual potential hazards to life or property. And we just appreciate the Northwestern's willingness to bolster what they already have in their manual to fulfill the requirements there and add a gas migration survey. So they'll add language to further meet the requirements of that code section.
So with this gas migration survey, would this be considered, I mean, maybe not an explicit requirement in the federal code, but maybe more of a best practice? Is that the right way to look at it?
It is. I know Mr. Solomon looked to other operators, industry best practice, and also worked with PHMSA in deciding that a gas migration survey would be a good addition, a safe addition for the company to make.
Do we know to what extent other natural gas distribution companies in serving South Dakota would have such a survey, gas migration survey?
Mr. Chairman, I know that at least two of the other major gas companies use gas migration surveys in evaluating incidents.
And if you say it, I mean, at least two, then I guess I'm led to believe that it's not just, you know, your local distribution companies, but also your larger entities with the bigger pipes moving from town to town that this would be a best practice for.
That's correct. This practice is on the federal form that's used to investigate accidents. It's on the federal form to do that. It's not a code requirement, but it's a best practice, yes.
Okay. Other questions? Any discussion or action? I'll just sort of throw out, I mean, I think this has been an interesting process to watch. I mean, I think as we've evolved, there's been a little bit better understanding about exactly, you know, what happened and what can be done on a go-forward basis. And so obviously appreciate in something that started out maybe a little more adversarial to see everybody kind of get to the same point, a settlement. This certainly seems reasonable, so I appreciate all the parties getting here. With that, I would move the commission to approve the settlement agreement. And then, I mean, is dismissal of the docket right, or just maybe closing of the docket? I don't know if it matters, but Mr. Smith?
No, I don't. I think this does represent a substantive settlement in the docket. So I think closing, I think accepting this if you want to, accepting this as a resolution, but then closing it.
Sure. Okay. That's the motion. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0.
Thank you, commissioners and staff. I appreciate your efforts.
Telecom One deals with arbitration requests to resolve issues relating to interconnection agreements with a number of companies, specifically dockets TC07-111, which actually has been resolved. So instead, starting with 112, 113, 114, 115, and 116, the commission is scheduled for a decision today. We've heard lots on this, so we're not scheduled to take any more testimony. That being said, if we have a particular issue and somebody's got to have some input to help us make a decision, I think we can have a little bit of leeway in that respect. I did, just prior to coming up here, file sort of a little matrix. There are so many issues and they're so complex that I sort of laid them out. I used as the basis Ms. Moore's matrix that she filed on July 29th. Those of you listening on the Internet, you can go to those docket pages and they should be uploaded there. I don't think any of the issues or questions will be a surprise to anybody. We've been dealing with them for quite some time. But since I filed it, I did make that available to my colleagues. And unless anybody's got any objections, that sort of, I think, provides us a blueprint for working through the issues. The first issue identified in the matrix was the recip comp rate. I've got three questions beneath that. We'll start with 1A. The question for 1A is, what is the forecasted demand for transport? Or rather, what demand level shall be used for the purposes of this proceeding? And with that, we'll open it up to any discussion and possible action on that issue by commissioners. And I'll kick it off, I guess. One of the big frustrations as part of this process, for me anyway, was that we didn't have a very good forecasted demand, if any forecasted demand. We sort of believed that maybe an OC-192 was required, but that there wasn't a matching between that and future demand. We sort of were using 2006 numbers and holding them static. I was always a little uncomfortable with that mismatch of designing a network on paper for the future but not having demand to support it. And because of that, I do think we need some additional information. I'm reticent to delay final conclusion of this this item any longer, but I really feel like we should have the petitioner go back, submit new forecasted demand, and obviously Alltel would be able to file any additional testimony, but that this is right now a hole in the record. We don't have the accurate information to decide this, and with that, we'll see if anybody else has any other comments.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Commissioner.
In reviewing all of the information, it certainly appears that there's some conflicting information and that the information that we did receive on the different methodologies certainly favor the parties that use those methodologies, and that in attempting to try to come up with a conclusion regarding the a forecast to use information that we received, or at least that was submitted on a basis of the 2006 test year, it just does not seem, I agree that it's not a good method of examining what the forecast is going to be. And I think the rate equivalency method is a better measurement, and that it would more accurately measure the traffic demand and give us that opportunity that we need. So I likewise am a bit reticent to ask that we continue this process on this particular portion of it, but I think it's necessary to have that additional information.
So, I mean, it just occurred to me now that I didn't even give any thought for what sort of time frame we'd want, you know, specifically with this forecasted demand for transport, when we would want parties to be able to bring that forth. I mean, I don't know, would it be just easier to have the parties get together and put together a procedural schedule? Ms. Wiest, any thoughts on that?
That would be my preference, that the parties would be given an opportunity and to work together and perhaps with staff to see if they can come up with a procedural schedule, and then perhaps to since we are requesting additional information, move the timeline for the final determination.
And is there a deadline for that action now?
Well, the parties have already agreed to move that deadline. I think right now it's at the February, the end of February. So I would just ask that the parties work together and with staff and discuss that issue.
Sure.
And if they're unable to come up with any procedural schedule, then they can certainly come back to us.
Sure. Thanks, Ms. Wiest. So with regard to, you know, just issue 1A, you know, what is the demand that will be used, or the transport demand with regard to this docket? I would move that the commission request additional information from the petitioner and that Alltel would also be allowed to file additional testimony. No second is required. Any further discussion? Hearing, yes, Commissioner Colbeck.
I was just going to say that, and then all the things that Ms. Wiest had suggested would apply to that item.
Yeah, it probably is worth adding into that motion that the parties would also be instructed to work with staff to put together a procedural schedule.
Okay. And this is?
Just for item 1A.
Okay. Okay. I understand the evidence. It was tough for me as a technical background to understand why it is, but I just can't see it in the record that justifies it. So I'm glad that we would take this avenue rather than to just deny and move on. So,
well, and I think you're, I mean, I just had a real hard time. We know that 2006 is not going to be an accurate representation of what future traffic's going to look like and how much of it there'll be and an area of unease. Any other discussion on with regard to 1A?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I should have looked at your matrix a little more closely. I believe I addressed what appears to be your 1A and 1B. So having forecasted my position on 1B, I certainly agree with what you've trifurcated on 1A, B, C, and C as questions.
You've always been a man ahead of your time. So, and certainly some of these issues are so interrelated, it will be difficult to keep them clean and deal with them singularly. But 1A, if there's no further discussion, we'll proceed to vote on the pending motion. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, we'll proceed to 1B. And the question I've got on the blueprint is, how shall transport demand be measured? There were each group sort of came with their own method. One was the PATH method. One was the DS1 equivalency. There was a third method, sort of the rate equivalency method that was addressed more briefly. Any discussion on this item?
I'll kick it off on this one. The PATH method actually was what I was going to, but both of them are flawed. I think I would have to agree with Commissioner Johnson or Commissioner Hansen on this one, since I know what he's thinking. But both, I think, have disappropriate amounts of costs. And again, if we're going to allow additional testimony in the first issue, I think it's only fair that we ask for additional information in the second issue. This 1B, this how shall transport demand be measured? So I would think that as Commissioner Johnson, Commissioner Hansen, I'm sorry, the equivalency method is the best, but we never had that information. So it's kind of hard when the record doesn't reflect any solid methods or any solid ways to determine cost. We're kind of stuck in the middle. I know some people may think that our job is to split the baby, but I would rather get the correct measurements and the correct method to make sure that this is right this time. So I'll agree with Commissioner Hansen. Use the equivalency method. And I guess I'll motion on 1B that we ask petitioners to add additional information to the record of the equivalency method.
Well, I think I'm headed the same place. I think you can make a pretty good logical argument, at least in theory, for either the PATH or the DS1 equivalent. I just think to me, I sort of feel like if you use either of the bookmarks, when you push the numbers through, you end up getting a result that does disproportionately assess costs. And maybe you end up driving public policy in a place that a more perfect system wouldn't. I've got a little bit of discomfort with the rate equivalency just because I don't feel like we had as much information on it. I don't feel like it's I didn't see a lot of evidence that it's been in widespread use across the country, that it's sort of the new regulatory norm. But it's sort of from a what are the real costs and what are the true, I mean, who should really pay for what? It does seem like it's got a lot going for it. So I'd concur. Any other discussion?
Well, I just don't. I'm glad we're going this way because the DS1 method I definitely don't agree with. But that doesn't make it right to choose the lesser of two evils. So I think that if we try to get the rate that is more realistic, in my feeling, go for the right solution.
Commissioner Hansen. Any further discussion?
I believe I voiced my opinions on this fairly clearly. We would obviously allow the parties to file additional information. That's the only way we could arrive at it.
Hearing no further discussion, we'll proceed to vote. Commissioner Kolbeck, you made a motion, and I might just add the same friendly amendment to yours that you added to mine, that we have the parties work together on a procedural schedule.
Yes, yes.
Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Hansen?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. 1C on the matrix asks, how shall the commission treat Alltel's other objections with regard to costs included in the petitioner's cost study? And we'll open that up to any discussion. I won't say out of hand, but in large part rejected, I think, Alltel's argument that you almost need to break apart a switch and only use those components that you have to have, to terminate this call. All that being said, I was a little uncomfortable with everything that you could possibly add onto a switch being considered usage sensitive and costs that, would be reasonable. The three that came out most clearly in my mind would be Kalia. I think it's the web self-care, it was called, and then Centrex. And so I would move that the commission have those costs excluded, but that the other parts of the switch could be included for the purposes of this proceeding. Any other discussion?
You just mentioned those three, and those are the only three exceptions, correct?
Yeah, those were the only three where I felt like the record was developed enough where I could say, that they absolutely did not belong in there. Something like Kalia, you got to have that no matter how big your switch is, the license is. There wasn't any evidence in the record that indicated the cost of your license increases with the size of the switch. To me, that just sort of seemed like the kind of thing that could relatively easily be excluded. Those costs shouldn't be passed on in the recip comp rate.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
I agree with you on at least those first two items. I'm wondering about web self-care, what the strengths of that would be to provide that as an exception.
Well, and for me, the one that was on the borderline for me was Centrex. And for web self-care, I didn't have much of a concern with throwing that out because, and again, maybe I'm wrong, but I felt like in the record that felt like almost a purely retail offering, an individual, retail user, a customer of one of these telcos would use that. That would allow them to interact with, their preferences, their characteristics. I didn't see how you needed to have that to serve, traffic from Alltel.
Okay. Thank you. I would not be in opposition to those items being excluded.
And particularly with, Kalea I think even testified that that was usage sensitive. And I actually think toward the end of the proceeding, we got some greater agreement from all of the parties on that particular component. But other comments? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Well, I think that resolves the issues, and if there are issues we're forgetting, you know, either of you or any of the advisors, you know, pop up, we kind of want to take related issues at the same time. But Ms. Moore's number two was inter-MTA factor and then also inter-MTA rate. I divided those up, and with 2A, I asked what method shall be used to determine appropriate inter-MTA use factors. And then once you decide that, it is pretty clear, I mean, given the method you choose, what use factors should be used, what specific numbers. Any discussion?
I'm referring back to your trying to coordinate my notes with your matrix here, so I'm having a little bit of a challenge.
This is another area, at least for me, where I had some frustration that maybe, of course, you never have perfect information, but there wasn't widespread agreement on which information we should use. I mean, if everybody remembers, we've got this SS7 study that was done, but I think there was a relatively valid argument to be made that that was relatively dated, both in terms of time. I wasn't as concerned about that, but also from network design, changes in the network design. And so do you use the SS7? Do you not use SS7? Do you use some other method? I don't know that there were easy answers, certainly.
I think that the SS7 method is the most solid. I think that's what we should be using. It more accurately reflects what the inter-MTA traffic is. I guess that would be my motion, that we would use the SS7 methodology for the inter-MTA use factors. Right there. I'll stop right there.
Any motion has been made, any discussion or questions on the motion? I think I might be with you, Commissioner Kolbeck. Did you have any concerns about the fact that, I mean, was this an L6 study, I think, maybe?
An 08?
Well, I don't think so, because this was an 07 docket.
This is 04.
I believe most of it was based on 2004, and there was one on 2005.
Well, that's right. That's right, 2004 data. We're not ever going to get perfect data on these sort of traffic studies, but what was kind of your thought process on that?
Well, the SS7 methodology, the way SS7 is transporting traffic right now, and then, is the same way SS7 traffic is transported today. So as far as the traffic studies are the way that you can determine how that call is originated or terminated are the same now as they were then. It's not necessarily traffic-sensitive or use-sensitive. It's more of a technology-sensitive issue.
Well, and we've got at least three. If we're going to use SS7 data, I mean, even if you sort of establish that as a given, then you've almost got three different, you know, flavors of that approach you can take. One would be, all right, let's use the 04, 05 SS7 study unchanged, essentially the RLEX approach.
Okay.
Altel made some revisions to that SS7 data. So you could use that, sort of the Altel SS7. And, you know, they indicated, as I think we all remember, that, well, that was Western Wireless's system. Altel system's different, so you've got a traffic study that doesn't even really deal with us as a company. And then I think the commission could argue that, okay, SS7 is the method we're going to use, but we're going to redo it. We're going to look at a new time frame. And what time frame, you know, do we use? So three different flavors. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, of the methods used, I believe the SS7 was correct, and my notes show that it was October 2004 studies that were used, except Kennebec had the first quarter of 2005. And certainly from that perspective, if they have 2008, then that's what we should be using.
And I, you know, my original thought process was, yeah, let's get some new data. The arguments made by the RLX were compelling to me, Commissioner, in that, well, when do you do the study? I mean, you say, okay, the first half of 08, I mean, that was after the parties filed in 07. Is there a potential, you know, I'll use the word gaming. I don't really mean it that way. I mean, I just mean you can tell your system, your network to route traffic and handle traffic in a lot of different ways. Could the numbers look differently because of how somebody designed a network than they would absent a sort of proceeding? I mean, does a proceeding like this choose people to change the way they route traffic? And so if you're doing analyzing data after people sort of know their network design is being watched, does that, even without them having any nefarious motivations, does that in a subtle way corrupt what the numbers look like? And also, if memory serves, this arbitration would be in effect for 3 years. You kind of always get another bite at the apple. 3 years from now, the traffic will look different and the network will look different. And 3 years after that, the traffic will look different, the network will look different. And so at some point, you just need to pick a number and go with it.
How extensive of a challenge is it to update those numbers, provide them to us?
Ms. Weiss, do you happen to recall from the record what people said?
I believe it was the petitioner's contention that the SS7 study was not all that difficult to do. I don't know what the cost would be for doing that study.
Your argument has credibility. I'm just curious how much of a challenge it would be to provide those numbers to us. If they're sitting on a desk, then it's one thing. If it costs a certain amount of money and time, and by the time we get them, it's 08 numbers for 010 for 10. I mean, it's...
I'm also not quite sure how long they keep the numbers for sure. I mean, if maybe they do keep them for if you're going to use 08 numbers, historical numbers, they certainly could have the numbers. I just don't know how far back they go.
Well, and I know we've got a lot of experts in the room and on the phone line. I'm a little reticent to open that up because they can tell us something, but whatever they tell us, I mean, it's not evidence at this point. We can't really use it to draft an order.
No.
So if we use it to change our minds or adjust fire a little bit, frankly, it could do us more harm than good from a legal standpoint. But that being said, I mean, geez, if somebody's got to know something to move forward, let's get it answered.
I'm prepared to make a motion if you'd like.
Go ahead.
I'd move that the commission accept the use of the SS7 methodologies proposed by McCook, Beresford, Kennebec, Santel, and West River.
Okay, so just so I make sure I've got it right, basically using the 04-05 traffic study, those numbers.
Information that we have.
Okay.
Whatever the record reflects currently.
Okay. Motion's been made. Any discussion on the pending motion? If not, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson will vote no. Motion carries 2-1. 2B is, should a netting of traffic be allowed? And to, kind of refresh everybody's memory, you've got this inter-MTA traffic, and to what extent should traffic going from Alltel, to what extent should traffic going the other way be netted against traffic headed the first way? Any discussion? I rejected the netting argument. I feel like you're essentially allowing Company X to charge Company Y's switch to access rates, and at some point, if you feel like you need to charge your traffic both ways, you really need to have a separate cost study to determine what honest costs are. And it may be that there's an asymmetry in costs. I don't know that, but in the absence of that kind of knowledge, it would be tough for me to allow netting. So I'll move that the commission not allow the netting. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Item 2C is, what rate shall be assessed to interstate MTA traffic and intrastate inter-MTA traffic? Any discussion? If there's no discussion, does anyone have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move that the commission find that the correct rate for interstate inter-MTA traffic is the petitioner's tariffed interest rate, and that the proper rate of interstate inter-MTA traffic is the petitioner's tariffed intrastate rate.
Okay. Motion has been made. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, we move to the last item under inter-MTA factor and rate, which is 2D on the blueprint. How shall traffic within Beresford be treated? Again, Beresford gets cut, if not right down the middle, at least somewhere in the middle of town. And how do you treat that traffic? I think there are at least two options, treated as local traffic or treated as inter-MTA traffic. Any discussion?
I rejected Altail's argument on that. I don't. I guess I'll move that the commission reject Altail's contention that the calls and Beresford subscribers from Altail numbers rated to Beresford should be treated as local calls, subject to reciprocal count. The MTA's right down the middle of the town. I just didn't buy their argument that that's what it should be handled as.
So Beresford traffic from, just so I make sure I got it right, Beresford traffic from one end of town over to the other end of town, that's inter-MTA traffic. We essentially use the Bright Line as the Bright Line.
Yes.
Okay. Motion has been made. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This was a real unique situation, and went back and forth trying to figure this out. And if you draw the line around the town somehow, and then there's development around the town, do you keep changing the boundary? How does this affect? How is this affected in a larger community, for instance, if whether it's a Minneapolis-sized community or if it's a Sioux Falls-type community? Where do you draw the boundary? If it's if you say it's going to be a mile out of town, and then all of a sudden you have development there, it just, the line's got to be the line. Otherwise, you keep moving it, and having a struggle and challenge. So I agree with him.
Well, I did think Altail had some strong arguments that, you know, the commission treating Beresford the way the pending motion would treat it sort of creates sort of an odd incentive to place a cell phone tower on this side of town as opposed to the other side of town. It does really create sort of a something just short of, well, it's not really a commonsensical treatment of the traffic. That being said, I mean, I agree with you, commissioners. I mean, I just feel like absent the commission sort of making a determination nearly out of whole cloth, I mean, I know that there was a rationale given, but at some point, if the line needs to be redrawn, I'm not really sure we've got all of the authority we would like to do something like that. So although I kind of think it's not a common sense treatment of that traffic, I'm not sure we got a whole lot of other options. So.
Well, I would agree. I guess that was my thought process was, if you allow me to go down memory lane, my grandpa actually lived in Beresford, and Beresford doesn't look like it did back then already. So being situated between Sioux City and Sioux Falls, if we were to redraw that line, I agree with Commissioner Hanson, we may have to redraw that line every 10 years as that city will grow. Both those Sioux Falls, Sioux City will grow into Beresford. So, and you bring up a very valid point that, do we even have the jurisdictional ability to redraw an MTA line to treat that traffic differently?
Well, and lines are sort of lines. I mean, there are a number of towns in South Dakota that are in two counties. They don't redraw the county lines. You know, Lemon, at least, is one community that is, as well as, you know, Sioux City that is kind of in multiple states. They're technically different municipalities, but they really function as a single community. They don't redraw the state boundaries to keep everybody together. Folks in North Lemon pay income taxes. Folks in South Lemon don't. Life's pretty unfair sometimes, I guess. So, all right. I think I can count to three as easy as the next guy, but let's take a vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Okay. Issue number three was factor billing and traffic factor. I think there's only one question yet to resolve on this, and that is, how shall intra-MTA traffic be calculated and billed? There were at least two options advanced. One was, okay, use actual traffic, and the other was to use some sort of a traffic factor derived by a study or otherwise. Any discussion? And I think this was just for McCook and Santel. I thought that using actual traffic was going to be a little cumbersome, and instead I just I really believe that, in fact, I'll just make a motion. The commission should accept the proposed net billing system, the one that Alltel suggested, and use those factors which Alltel put into the record. And I think this is going to get us where we need to go as far as allowing Alltel the ability to get the compensation for that intra-MTA traffic. Discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chairman, I think I would agree that Alltel's definitions most closely aligned in the definition of what it should be.
Any other discussion? With that, the pending motion is to use traffic factors rather than actual traffic for the intra-MTA traffic. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
I'm going to vote no on that one.
Okay. Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 2-1. We skip from 3-6 because, as Ms. Moore's matrix identified, all of the issues, issues in 4 and 5 were settled by all parties. We get to the MTA definition. The question still to resolve is which MTA definition shall be used. The RLEX put forth one and Alltel put forth one. Any discussion?
I like the Alltel definition.
The Alltel one is pretty standard. It's kind of what you always see. I agree. With that, we'll say Commissioner Colbeck made a motion to adopt the Alltel definition of inter-MTA and intra-MTA traffic. We'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. And finally, we come to, in the matrix file in July, it said Direct Connect and POI, although I think at this point, because there was, we gathered widespread agreement about the Direct Connect issue, and so now the only question is what points of interconnection shall be required. Any discussion?
I really had some reservations about the Alltel argument of where interconnection should happen and how it should happen. I do agree with the co-op's interconnection standards or how they want to interconnect. I think that that is their network, and I believe that I'll move that the commission accept McCook's, Beersford's, Kennebec, Sandtails, and West River's proposed points of interconnection.
Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, we're going to pause. Are there issues left unresolved? And anybody should feel free to stand up. Mr. Zorich. Is that microphone on, Mr. Zorich?
It is now. Just one thing that I'd point out. I believe your decision under 1C may require the LEX to go back and split those costs out, because I think some of those costs were lumped into a lump sum cost. And I don't think you put in your motion and request or an order to the LEX to go back and break those costs out.
I think you're right. We said those costs don't belong, but I don't know that we ever ordered a revision of the numbers. I think you're right. Ms. Weiss, any comments?
Yes, that's correct.
So with that, we'll make an additional motion to instruct the petitioners to revise their cost study to remove those items, the three that were specifically tossed out, so to speak. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks, Mr. Mazurk. Other issues, large or small, that are dangling?
I would just encourage both parties to... Hopefully their procedural schedule will be short. We can move on with this, get these other two items out of the way, and get this resolved, hopefully before the end of summer.
Well, I'm sure they want to be done with it just as much or more than we do, so I'm sure you're right. Okay, other questions? If not, then we'll move on. Thanks for everybody's patience with that. We probably should have held that to the end of the agenda. That's my fault, and I apologize to other folks waiting for us. Telecom item 2 is TC08-105, That's a request from Mid-Continent Communications for approval to provide local exchange service in a rural area. And specifically, the question for the commission today is, shall it grant the motion to find a rural exemption waived? And really, how shall the commission proceed? We dealt with this a little bit at the commission's last meeting. And, well, I'll just pause and we'll hear from the parties specifically. Mr. Gerdes, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, my name is Dave Gerdes. I'm a lawyer from Pierre, and I represent Mid-Continent in this docket. We have in this docket agreed to a procedural schedule, which was filed a few days ago, and are in the process of agreeing to a hearing date, subject to commission approval, to take what I'll call the other track, rather than the waiver of the exemption under of the rural exemption under that particular rule. However, I can't see how the commission can grant the motion or deny the motion to find the rural exemption waived. We've never brought it on for hearing. What the commission did most recently was to deny our motion to compel discovery, which it was the commission's prerogative, and of course that particular piece of discovery has now stopped. But nonetheless, there has never been an evidentiary hearing or any kind of hearing on the motion to find the rural exemption waived, and we would submit that that's a matter that for now is in limbo, but certainly could be resurrected sometime if, for instance, all Alliance started offering video, as an example. And so it would be my position that the motion is there. We've not asked to bring it forward for hearing, and it can stay there. And right now we are proceeding on the petition.
Well, I think you're right, Mr. Gerdes. There may be a formality we need to tie up here before moving toward a hearing. I'm not sure. We can check with Ms. Weiss, but I think you're right. Maybe the wording on the pending motions for the commission today isn't quite what we'd like. And from a practical standpoint, at our last hearing, we sort of resolved some of these preliminary issues. Ms. Weiss?
I think it would be all right if the commission were just to proceed with the procedural schedule and more or less defer the motion on the rural exemption. Would that be your understanding?
Yeah, I should have said defer. Excuse me. Yes.
Is there? I guess I would ask the other party if they have any response to that.
Any objection by staff or any other party?
Mr. Chairman, this is Meredith Moore on behalf of Alliance Communications. I would concur with Mr. Gerdes's assessment of where we are currently at with the procedural schedule and how the parties intend to proceed at this point. With respect to Mid-Continent's motion to deem the rural exemption waived, to a certain extent, I think the commission did deem that denied through its decision on the motion to compel discovery, simply because necessarily encompassed within that motion to compel discovery was a determination of whether that statute that's at issue, the rural exemption statute, discusses a current ability to provide cable or whether there's a future ability to provide cable. And I think what was established on the record was that Alliance is not currently providing cable. So I think the commission could at this point in time affirmatively rule that that Alliance has done nothing to waive the rural exemption at this point in time. However, should Mid-Continent become aware of any facts in the future that would lead it to believe that Alliance is engaging in some sort of new conduct, such as to render the rural exemption a nullity, then Mid-Continent could certainly renew its motion and move for expedited relief. And I would represent to the commission that If it becomes apparent in the near future that Alliance is going to be offering cable, we certainly don't intend to make some sort of fiction out of a hearing and proceed to that and waste everyone's time. That certainly does nothing to enhance the credibility of either myself or my client in that particular regard. However, I would think that what the commission could do would be deem the rural deem that the rural exemption has not been waived as of this time, subject to any later amendments or renewals of Mid-Continent's motion. Thank you.
Well, and maybe I'll pick up on that a little bit, Ms. Moore, and you've mostly addressed it, but just to kind of close it out, I mean, you know, we've got entered in, you know, into the record that at least consumers, you know, in that area are being told that video is likely coming to their homes sometime soon. I mean, would it be easier for the parties in this case to just communicate and say, well, geez, here's our date. Here's when we expect to flip the switch. And rather than go through this legal proceeding, you know, Midco, you can't start rolling out the services until that day, but that's the day when functionally we waive our rural exemption. Thoughts, Ms. Moore?
Mr. Chairman, I would love to say that's a possibility. However, in the case of Alliance, it's simply not. With respect to flipping a switch, I would agree that with the advanced technology that Midco has available to it and the fact that it's engaged in the provisioning of that service for a significant amount of time, I think it is as easy as flipping a switch. For Midco, it's not the same for a company such as Alliance. However, if it becomes readily apparent that Alliance is able to do that, I certainly don't have any problem communicating with Mr. Gerdes and letting him know that. It's just a question of I can't give a definitive date to anyone at this point in time, given the stage of construction that's ongoing, as well as just making sure all the kinks are worked out to actually pick that date. There is no date picked at this point in time. So I understand your concern. Certainly, I have no objection to communicating with Mr. Gerdes and being very open about that. I just can't pick a date at this particular time.
Well, and I think Mr. Gerdes said you all filed a procedural schedule. I mean, last week, I haven't looked at it yet, and presumably if you're all in agreement, I mean, I'm okay with that, but we just hate to get all the way through this and figure out 2 weeks later that, you know, video's coming. So, and I know you know that, and I know it's not in your client's best interest to do that anyway. So,
if I may, Mr. Chairman, just on that subject, I don't think for either party it's just a matter of flipping a switch, or at least from McConnell's standpoint, it can't be, because we still have to have an interconnection agreement, and we have to go through the physical process of effecting an interconnection of the equipment. So it's not quite that simple, and that's kind of why we've been pushing on this. Now, that having been said, I don't disagree with anything that's been said. I just don't want the commission to get the idea that somehow somebody can flip a switch and all of a sudden it starts. It's more complicated than that, and there is an affidavit in the record to that effect.
But. Well, and I would presume that it is more difficult for both companies than probably just flipping a switch, because any time I get a new telecommunications or video service, somebody charges me $40 for it, so to flip that switch. But let's look to Ms. LaBrie-Baker or Ms. Kramer for their comments.
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. I didn't know if Rich Coit, did you want to, he's an intervener, if you wanted to comment.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, thank you. Thank you, staff. I would really just concur in Meredith's comments. One thing that I'm not, you know, exactly sure of at this moment with respect to the waiver of the rural exemption. I mean, the claim has been obviously that, you know, at the point that Alliance begins actually providing video or is providing video, that it waives the rural exemption. There are also other provisions that result basically in a termination of that exemption, you know, where you make findings, factual findings that, you know, it's not unduly economically burdensome or it's not technically infeasible. And I can't recall, Mr. Gerdes, whether that was something that you had raised in that motion or not, or whether it was based purely on just the providing a video. And that being the case, I guess that would give me more reason to concur with Ms. Moore's comments that at least based on what you've heard to date, you probably would be in a position where you could make some finding that the rural exemption isn't waived, you know, based on the prior argued interpretation of the law. But I really don't have any problem with holding it in advance. So, I mean, basically tabling it, and he can renew the motion should the facts change.
Well, I'm glad you brought up, I mean, there is a distinction between waiver and termination, and to the extent that we go to hearing, I mean, absent a new service provision, I mean, termination would be essentially what Mid-Continent is arguing for. Is that right, Mr. Gerdes?
I don't understand what the context you're using the term termination.
Well, as Mr. Coit said, I mean, a company, you know, sort of voluntarily waives the rural exemptions if they offer video service. There are some other things they can do that wouldn't necessarily constitute a voluntary waiver, but would effectively terminate those safeguards.
I suppose if they voluntarily waived the safeguards, yeah. But
well, of course, through the provision of video.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, but I guess what I mean, what I'm saying is just Mid-Continent will defer the motion until such time as it's warranted by the facts. I think we're kind of arguing about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin here, really.
I guess the only reason I bring that up is we are kind of looking at a schedule where we're looking at a hearing in May. If we have the hearing prior to the time that, you know, Alliance is providing any video services, the rural exemption issue may still be there, depending on, you know, whether Midco wants to proceed with that termination argument or not, which certainly may be relevant from a standpoint of, you know, what their intentions are with respect to interconnection, or what they want with regard to a point of interconnection, whether they want any resale, that sort of thing. So to the extent that Alliance is not providing video when we have the hearing, you know, the rural exemption is still there. I think at some point it's going to have to be clarified, you know, whether Midco is going to try to proceed to terminate it under the other provisions or just wait until it's waived.
Well, my understanding is that was what the hearing is about termination of the exemption. We're putting into abeyance the part about the whether it has been waived or not, but the procedural schedule, was my understanding, was to address the question on the termination of the exemption, because that was your second part of your amended motion.
That's correct. You are correct. I agree with what you're saying.
So my recommendation would be, at this time, I think we can put the motion to find rural exemption waived, just put it in abeyance at this time, but go forward with the procedural schedule on the question of whether to terminate the rural exemption.
I mean, neither of those would require a motion. Is that right? I mean, we often adopt procedural schedules just as a matter, or sort of as a ministerial act. If you prefer, we can certainly make a motion, but again, to hold an abeyance requires no action.
Right, and so at this point, they did file a proposed procedural schedule, and we do have a question about how shall the commission proceed. Would there be any objection if the commission, many times we have actually ruled on filed procedural schedules. Is there any problem with, do any parties have any objection to the commission accepting or approving that procedural schedule?
Not from Mid-Continent.
So, I mean, you know, we routinely rule on procedural schedules when there's not complete agreement, but there are also some instances where we don't. We sort of allow them to set their own procedural schedule. This is one of those instances. I mean, I certainly don't mind voting on it, but does...
I'm trying to read through it to see how they... sometimes it depends on how they filed it.
Sure.
They filed it as a stipulation. I think that the commission could approve the stipulation for scheduling order.
Alliance would have no objection to that, commission.
Our staff, did you have anything different?
No, I would agree with your assessment to hold this in abeyance. The only thing I would note on the stipulation is that the hearing actually date that we're looking at is June 2nd. I suspect by then construction season will be well underway and things will have changed mightily as to what the evidence may be. So with that in mind, I would agree with Ms. Wiest.
I'll make a motion to approve the stipulated procedural schedule. Any discussion? Hearing none, proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, we'll proceed to Telecom 3, which is TC08-110. It is an application by Native American Telecom LLC for a local exchange COA. The question for the commission today, however, is shall it dismiss and close the docket? The moving party is Native American Telecom LLC, and we will hear from Native American Telecom.
Thank you, Commissioner. Talbot Weiser-Arik for Native American Telecom.
I also have Gene DeGiordi with company is on the line, and then Chairman Brandon Zazu with Crow Creek Indian Reservation Tribal Council is here too.
Mr. Chairman, welcome.
The tribe submitted comments. I've asked the chairman whether he had want to speak to those, and he demurred to me to encapsulate those within my comments. This is a request that Native American Telecom be allowed to withdraw their application. The request is fairly straightforward. It's allowed under your rules. Staff's brief points that out fairly clearly, that that your rules provide for a withdrawal by the party that's seeking the application. Native American Telecom has not made any secret that it intends to offer telecom services on Crow Creek within the exterior boundaries pursuant to an order granted by the Crow Creek Utility Authority. That's a an established authority on the reservation under the inherent authority that the Tribal Council has to establish and regulate matters amongst its own members and people on the reservation. I believe it's uncontested, and I'm not going to go through all the case law on it. I don't believe anybody can reasonably argue that a tribe does not have jurisdiction to authorize a party to provide services to its members. And frankly, if you look through the intervener's argument against the motion to dismiss, the interveners essentially argue that there's a question as to jurisdiction as to non-members. I think the case law is fairly clear that as to non-members who are voluntarily living on the reservation and voluntarily deal with tribes or tribal authorized entities, that there's exclusive jurisdiction for the tribe to deal with those issues too. I don't believe that's been anything but settled law for the last decade. So I think at this point it would be appropriate for the commission to do two things. Well, essentially allow us to withdraw the application, but I also think it would be practical for the commission to go and recognize the jurisdiction of the tribal authority. For the sole purposes of, if you look at the brief, at least as to tribal members, the brief of the ILX, they don't argue that issue. And I think it's prudent for the commission, as part of the order, to recognize, at least to the tribal members, which doesn't appear to be at issue, that that jurisdiction exists down in the, with the Tribal Council and the Tribal Utility Authority. And the reason I think it's prudent for the commission to make that ruling as part of this dismissal is to prevent the minute a tribal member signs up with a tribal authorized entity from an ILEC filing a complaint here and you're dealing with it then. We might as well at least address that issue. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell the commission that jurisdictional issues within the exterior borders of reservations can be very muddy water. There's a lot of different cases on it. The issue when it deals with tribes and their members, though, are crystal clear, and that jurisdiction rests with the tribes. I think the case law as to members who voluntarily or non-members that live within the exterior boundaries who voluntarily go into business with tribal authorized entities, I think the case law there is crystal clear. The only question as to regulations that becomes more muddy is if somebody is not on tribal ground within the exterior boundaries and they don't know they're dealing with a tribal authorized entity, whether that jurisdiction is exclusive. So I think today the commission can kind of cut right to it, let us withdraw, let us operate under that authority, give us some clear direction where you think that jurisdiction is exclusive, and then if the benefit of giving that is it prevents potentially a complaint, and it says to Native American Telecom, if you're dealing with people in this matter, we understand the Tribal Council and the Tribal Utility Authority is the place people have to go. If you get over into this other area, well, then maybe you need to come back for the COA. So to the extent commissioners can make that determination today, like I said, I think the ILX brief gives you as to members. I think you can go further than that. I take any questions specifically on the legal aspects or this kind of a, these tribal issues get kind of unique sometimes in the jurisdictional questions.
Thanks, Mr. Wazorek. My preference would be to hold questions until we hear from all parties. Interveners, Mid-States, Venture, and SDTA were granted intervention. Any of those parties have comment?
Thank you again, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Darla Rogers, and I represent Interveners Venture Communications and Mid-State in this docket. Interveners would first of all like to address some procedural matters, and then second of all get more to the merits of a motion to dismiss. I would note, first of all, that the interveners disagree with the position either in stated or implied by staff and others that a party such as Native American Telecom has an absolute right to voluntarily dismiss its application. I believe the applicable rule here for the commission to look at is 20-10-0102.04, and that's the rule that governs withdrawal or dismissal of a pleading. That rule provides for dismissal prior to entry of a final order by the commission only if a stipulated agreement is filed, signed by all the parties, and even then only if the commission does not find that the public interest requires the proceeding to continue. So in this case, you do not have a stipulated agreement, and you have other interveners or parties that have been, that are in this docket. That is...
Could you maybe say that site one more time so I can write it down?
Sure. ARSD 20-10-01-02-04.
Okay. Thanks. Go ahead.
I have a copy of it here. I just want to make sure I gave you the correct site. That particular... rule is supported by the South Dakota Rules of Civil Procedure, and specifically I refer to SDCL 15-6-41A, which governs voluntary dismissals. What that rule says is the only time an action may be dismissed by a plaintiff without order of the court is before there's been an answer served in the case, or by filing a stipulation of all the parties who have appeared in the action. 20-10-01-02-04 does, I believe, grant this commission the authority to dismiss a pleading at the request of an interested party or on its own motion, but the commission must state the reasons for the dismissal. And I would suggest that that is also consistent with the rules of civil procedure. A little bit more guidance, however, can be found in our state statutes. For example, if the court orders a dismissal, the court can order terms and conditions of that dismissal. And I think that's similar to our rule or your rule that says you have to state the reasons. But our state statute also provides that if a defendant files a counterclaim prior to a motion to dismiss, then the action shall not be dismissed against the defendant's objection unless the counterclaim can remain and be independently adjudicated. In the current docket, the interveners obviously have not filed a counterclaim. We really don't have that proceeding in rules. However, they have filed for and have been granted party status in this docket. And I believe that that's significant for a couple of reasons. Number one, it does give them the right and standing to object to dismissal of the docket, and that seems to have been questioned by Native American Telecom. But the second thing it does is it places the interests of the interveners in front of you as a commission as well. It adds their interests, the interests of other parties in the docket, to the mix when you're determining what to do and whether to order a dismissal. The interveners do have a direct interest in this case. They would be directly and immediately affected by a commission order in this docket. So, therefore, I believe under the procedural rules in place, excuse me, this commission must afford all the parties the opportunity to respond and present evidence on issues of fact and argument on issues of law and policy. And I would direct your attention to SDCL 1-26-18, which concerns parties that have been granted intervention. So I guess what I'm saying is procedurally, we do not agree that a party has the right to dismiss or withdraw a docket. In the absence of a stipulation among all the parties, a pleading may only be dismissed by order of this commission. And then you must state the reasons for that dismissal. So then I'm going to move now to what I believe are the reasons that you should not grant a motion to dismiss in this docket. The first reason I would point to is the statute that governs certificates of authority, and that's SDCL 49-31-3. It's hard to imagine how a statute could be much clearer. That statute states that telecommunications companies seeking to provide any local exchange service or inter-exchange service shall submit an application for certification by this commission. And the second thing provided in 49.31.3 is that this commission has exclusive authority to grant a COA. I don't believe that the law could be much clearer, and apparently even Native American Telecom must have interpreted the law the same way because it went ahead and filed this application. We're not talking about taxation here. We're not talking about ETC designation. We're not talking about rate regulation. What happens with all those issues is down the road. We are talking about submitting an application for a certificate of authority, and every company providing service in this state or wanting to must submit an application, and you have exclusive authority to grant that. I don't believe that there's anything in federal law that changes that. Nothing in the federal act gives tribal utilities authority over COAs. Nothing in the federal act gives the FCC authority over COAs. In that case, the state law governs. The federal act does not step in and make a determination of whether or not the state has jurisdiction over the COA. The only law here is your state law, and it gives you that exclusive authority. So I would urge you to look to state law as one reason that you should proceed with this docket. You have factual issues to determine. Native American Telecom needs to go through the same exact steps as any other company wanting to provide telecommunications service in the state of South Dakota. The second reason I would suggest to you that you should deny the motion to dismiss is the protection of interests of other parties and the public, and I've alluded to that to a certain extent. Native American Telecom is no longer the only party in this proceeding. Venture, Midstate, SDTA are all parties. Venture and Midstate in particular have interests and rights that must be protected as well. SDCL 1-26-18 affords all parties the opportunity to respond, to present evidence on issues of fact and argument on issues of law or policy. There are issues of fact in this docket. Does Native American Telecom have sufficient technical, financial, and managerial capabilities to offer the telecommunications services described in its application? The other parties in a contested case are entitled to due process. They have the right to submit argument and on policies and evidence on issues of fact and policy. If the commission dismisses this docket, how are the other parties afforded the opportunity to respond and present evidence? If Native American Telecom is a competitive local exchange area, and that's what they're purporting to be in their application, who protects the interests of the incumbent carriers? including rural safeguards, there isn't any other entity to do that other than this commission. If Native American Telecom seeks interconnection with incumbent LECs, which it has stated in its application that it has, who approves or enforces those agreements? If an agreement can't be reached, who arbitrates them? So your job is not just to protect the applicant or to make a ruling on the application in this case. Now there are other parties. They have interests, and it's your job to protect those interests as well. I think the timing of events here is interesting, and I would just note that parenthetically. Native American Telecom did apply to this commission for a COA, and they've requested interconnection negotiations. Then apparently they went to the Tribal Utilities Commission. They received an order of authorization there. Now they're back before this commission and asking you to dismiss their application for a COA, apparently saying we choose to avoid your exclusive authority over the grant of a COA in favor of what the tribe has done. But Native American Telecom nor the tribe, none of us, this commission, we don't operate in a vacuum. You cannot circumvent the exclusive authority of this commission over granting of a COA. You cannot circumvent that by going to the tribe and getting an order of authority there. And there's nothing under federal law that would allow that to happen. And there's a reason for this. According to our South Dakota Supreme Court, the authority of the PUC is extensive and crucial to the overall regulatory scheme, not only with regard to Native American Telecom, but also with regard to Venture, Midstate, any other providers in the state. I would concur slightly, not completely, with Mr. Wieczorek's comments concerning the protection of the interest of the public and your duties in that regard. I would say that there is a difference of interpretation of case law with regard to the duties of this commission as it relates to regulation of tribal and non-tribal members. I don't think the law in this area is crystal clear in any aspect. I think that this commission, however, can gain guidance from what has happened before by our South Dakota Supreme Court. And I think that it would be helpful for you, it certainly was for me, to look at the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe case. And you'll recall that that's the case where U.S. West was selling a lot of exchanges to a consortium of local exchange carriers. And in that case, this commission denied approval of the sale of some of those exchanges to the Cheyenne River Sioux Telephone Authority. And the question that this court considered in the case of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe was whether or not this commission had the jurisdiction to deny approval of the sale of those exchanges to CRST. I thought that the court did a very, very careful analysis of the case law and also the statutes. The case law concerning whether or not under the Montana U.S. Supreme Court case there was either preemption by federal law or whether this commission was usurping or infringing upon the rights of the tribe to self-government. What our Supreme Court ultimately said in that case, and that was concerning whether or not this commission had the jurisdiction to deny approval of the sale of even the portion of the exchange, the Timberlake exchange that was on the reservation. Did this commission have the authority to deny approval of that sale? Our Supreme Court ultimately said, yes, you did have that authority. Why did you have that authority? Because you were granted that exclusive authority by statute, because there wasn't anything in federal law that preempted that, and by looking at the overall regulatory structure and goals of Congress, you were not improperly infringing on the rights of the tribe to self-governance. So I believe that the case law in South Dakota and our Supreme Court can give you guidance, and it would support denial of the motion to dismiss and proceeding to the merits of the application. Finally, I would point out, excuse me a minute while I find my notes, that a third reason that I believe it would be behoove you to look at denying this motion is the precedential effect that such a ruling could have. If you dismiss this application, where does that leave us? NAT or Native American Telecom suggests that there are different forums, such as a complaint proceeding for determination of these issues. I would submit, and interveners would suggest, that there is no more appropriate forum than the one in front of you right now. Ruling, the reason that Native American Telecom is requesting you to deny this application is because they have authority under the Tribal Utilities Commission to provide service, and they're going to limit that service to the exterior boundaries of the reservation. In other words, what Native American Telecom says is you should dismiss this case, this application, because we are not going to engage in any activities over which this commission has jurisdiction, because we're going to confine everything to the reservation. Interveners disagree with that position for several reasons. Number one, telecommunications services, by their very nature, can never be confined to boundaries or lines drawn in the sand. Whether they're intrastate calls, interstate calls, the service itself provided, calls are going to go outside of the boundaries, they're going to come in from outside of the boundaries, people are going to go across the boundaries. There are all kinds of reasons why you cannot restrict that type of service to these boundaries. Second of all, I believe that position ignores the regulatory framework in place under our laws in South Dakota. You have exclusive jurisdiction over any company seeking to provide services in South Dakota. Under our Supreme Court ruling, nothing in federal law changes that, and there is nothing to show that proceeding with this COA application infringes on tribal self-governance. The third reason is that NAT's position ignores the protection of the rights of the other parties, that is the interveners, and that is your duty as well to protect them. It would also ignore the ruling of the Cheyenne River case, which affirms your jurisdiction over these types of actions, and it ignores the rights of consumers. And according to the Cheyenne River Supreme Court case, both on and off the reservation, the consumers are the ultimate parties that you need to be concerned about. In this case, we need to remember Native American Telecom is not a tribe. It's not a tribal entity. It's a company, just like U.S. West, just like Venture, just like Midstate. That company that wants to or intends to provide telecommunications services in this state must come to this commission for a certificate of authority. Any precedent you may set by dismissing this application would, in essence, if you do it for the reasons requested, would you not then be conceding that the tribe has exclusive jurisdiction over services offered within reservation boundaries, even granting of a certificate of authority? And that's contrary to your own statutes. And if we go to a subsequent proceeding, whether a complaint docket or some other declaratory ruling, whatever it might be, how is that presumption overcome in a subsequent proceeding? Then there would be no opportunity to protect the interests of other consumers and parties, because you've already ruled, because you've got to state your reasons, and the reasons requested here are that they want to withdraw because the tribe has given them authority and they're going to only provide service within the exterior boundaries. If Native American Telecom wants to challenge the jurisdiction of this commission over a certificate of authority, and if you do not want to face or rule on those issues or challenges within this docket, the answer is still not to dismiss it. Native American Telecom or the tribe can challenge your authority or your jurisdiction over a certificate of authority in a court, in a declaratory ruling. But the answer is not to dismiss this docket and have any precedential effect. The answer or an alternative would be, let's hold this proceeding in abeyance until the court rules on the jurisdictional issue, and then we will proceed depending on in accordance with how that court rules. So for those reasons, I would urge you not to grant the motion to dismiss, because if you grant that motion, you have to set forth your reasons. And as I've pointed out, and we've tried to point out, we don't believe there are any valid reasons to grant dismissal of the certificate of authority under the rules, the laws, the case law that exists in this case. We would urge you to look at alternative actions instead. Thank you.
Ms. Rogers, do you represent all interveners, or does Mr. Coit represent SDTA?
I believe Mr. Coit will speak on behalf of SDTA if
Wonderful.
He has anything to add.
Great. Thanks, Mr. Coit. After this, we'll hear from staff, and then we'll allow Mr. Wazorek and his client an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. Richard Coit on behalf of the South Dakota Telecommunications Association. I will try to keep this very brief, given the lateness of the day. First, I would note that we concur in Ms. Rogers' argument, and in the written response to the motion to dismiss, that we would reiterate, reemphasize those arguments. With respect to this request for withdrawal, it's somewhat difficult to object to a filing party's request for a dismissal of their own docket. But the fact is, SDTA is one of the parties, as well as Mid-State and Venture Communications. And this case, for a couple of reasons, we really feel that we need to strongly oppose this request for dismissal. Obviously, if you look at what the request is based on, it's based on jurisdictional issues. We would disagree that those issues are well settled, in particular, given the fact that we are dealing with an entity that is providing telecommunications services that is not a tribal entity. And there is no indication that we can see in the filed documents thus far by Native American Telephone that they intend to limit their services to tribal members. And given those facts, certainly there are some, I would say, legitimate jurisdictional issues here, and we are very concerned if the commission decides to dismiss this docket, what that will be perceived to be, and whether that will create some presumption against this commission's jurisdiction to regulate the provisioning of telecommunication services to any end users that reside on tribal land. So we're very concerned about the potential ramifications of a commission decision dismiss this docket. And I think it would be hard to avoid a decision that does not in some way represent a determination that you do not have jurisdiction with respect to services provided, telecommunication services provided on tribal land. So that's why we're here. That's why we're objecting. One reason, anyway. The other reason is, if we look at what we have before us for facts right now, we have a company that has indicated specifically that it intends to provide, quote, facilities-based basic telephone, unquote, services. Secondly, it's indicated in its application for a certificate of authority, or it did indicate in paragraph 8 of its application, that it planned to provide services beginning December 1st, 2008. Well, they haven't commenced providing services yet, to my knowledge, but they certainly have every intention of commencing the provisioning of services as soon as they can. If we look at the statutes, that deal with certification is one thing, in addition to what Ms. Rogers pointed out. There's also a statement in 4931.3 that says applications required by this section shall be filed by the company no less than 60 days before its initiation of telecommunications services. So we have statutes on certification that are intended to be applied by this commission before an entity commences the provisioning of its telecommunications services. So if this docket is dismissed, and we are sitting with basically a presumption that this commission doesn't have jurisdiction, and Native American Telephone Company proceeds on that presumption that it can go ahead and provide service, the question is raised, what next? What occurs? Do we file a complaint, or does the commission act on its own? And, you know, where do we ultimately end up? Do we end up right back here 4 months from now, in a situation where they're already providing service, and then you have to address the certification application and issues with respect to their technical, financial, and managerial capabilities, and issues with respect to rural safeguards after they've already commenced service? That does not seem to give too much credence to what the law is. And we would urge the commission to, for that reason, not dismiss this. One thing that I would also like to point out is with respect to the right of a party to withdraw, we do not agree that, you know, it is an absolute right, and staff didn't indicate that it was an absolute right, but just kind of indicated generally that it is. If you look at the dismissal provisions where parties are involved, there's an indication that there should be a stipulated agreement prior to dismissal. This commission also has the ability to consider the public interest in looking at issues or a request to dismiss. And I think that there is one statute to me that clearly justifies this commission keeping this docket open, and that is the SDCL 4913.4, which provides this commission the authority to not only investigate complaints, but also to make inquiry or investigate without complaint. And that statute in pertinent part says, the commission may at any time institute an inquiry or investigation on its own initiative in any case involving any matter over which the commission has jurisdiction concerning a complaint that is authorized to be made and filed with the commission by any provision of any law of this state, or concerning any question which may arise or relate to the enforcement of any provision of any law of this state. We have facts before us that indicate that they do intend to provide basic telephone services. The jurisdictional questions are not easy. They are not, in all cases, settled. Certainly, they're a little more settled when we're talking about services to tribal members. But it is muddy. And under the circumstances, we feel, given the fact that they very clearly are going to provide basic telephone services, you should start with a presumption that you have jurisdiction. Start with that presumption. And that, in our view, compels you to ensure or do your best to ensure that they're complying with the law. And the law requires that they proceed with an application for certification before they commence providing service. And we believe that if this dismissal is granted, it's going to send the wrong message that you know, you possibly don't have jurisdiction. And then we may have to come back and file a complaint and make arguments that you do. Or, you know, we're in a situation where we have to wait until actually after they commence providing service to complain. That's not a situation that we feel is really consistent with what the law requires with respect to certification. We are concerned that it will be interpreted in the wrong way from a jurisdictional perspective if there is dismissal, and that's probably our major concern. And that, in our view, could have some pretty extensive and far-reaching effects in terms of the commission's ability to continue to protect the public interest with respect to services that are provided by private private carriers on tribal lands. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coit. Staff?
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff, and I truly will be brief. As Native American Telecom has an absolute right to voluntarily dismiss its application, and there's no special reason why the dismissal should not be granted. There's no prejudice suffered by the interveners. Staff recommends that the commission grant the motion to dismiss and close the docket. As to Mr. Wazorik's suggestion on jurisdiction, staff does not disagree with him on his assessment. As to jurisdiction pertaining to tribal members receiving services on tribal on the reservation, but I don't believe that is the question before you, and I would not address that at this time. Thank you.
Mr. Wazorik.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to just address a couple of issues raised by the interveners. They continue to come back to only law is your state law. Well, if you go back to the Montana case, and that's this kind of the seminal Supreme Court case from 1981, the only law this state had at that point as to hunting laws was everybody hunting in South Dakota had to have a state hunting license. That's not true. The courts have clearly said, hey, look, if you're on tribal ground and you're making yourself subject as a non-member to tribal jurisdiction, you're subject to tribal laws, not state laws. And that applies to the regulatory laws, too. Tribes have the inherent power under federal law, under the general federal law, the establishment of tribes, to regulate their own members and the relationship those members have with non-members on the reservation. You know, they point to the South Dakota case, but if you look at the South Dakota case at paragraph 23, when they talk about the Montana case, the South Dakota Supreme Court acknowledges that the tribe may regulate non-members who enter into consensual contractual relationships with the tribe. Native American Telecom is a non-member entering into a consensual contractual relationship with the tribe and tribal's members. That is clearly, unquestionably under the law, under the jurisdiction of the tribe. I would agree, as I think I said up here earlier, you get further out there with non-members, you know, is it a non-member on tribal ground, even though he's within the exterior boundary? That becomes far more muddy. The reason I suggest to the commission that those issues are an issue to wait to receive, maybe, and to have the facts develop, is number one, you don't have the jurisdiction for the tribal members. For a non-member, the case law often turns on, is that non-member operating on tribal trust ground? Cases generally say if a non-member operates on tribal trust ground, he subjected himself to that jurisdiction of the tribe. However, under numerous federal acts, there's land within tribal exterior boundaries that are owned by non-members and is no longer in trust. The courts tend to say that those tend to fall under state law. Now, I think it's clear, and I think it's clear for dismissal that there's no question but that exclusive jurisdiction rests with the tribe and the tribal members. The gray area becomes the non-members. I don't think there's any gray area if it's a non-member operating within or on land owned by the tribe or held in trust. The fact that the state law talks in generalities, giving you the power over all telecom, it sounds good. It seems practical, but the federal law is clear. It just doesn't apply to the tribes. They're a federal institution. And the case law for the last 35 years has said that. The dismissal, or the withdrawal, I think, is appropriate. Mr. Coit says, well, let's fight this issue out here. I don't think a COA application's made for that type of proceeding, those types of questions. I think when you cut through the briefs and even when you reflect on how they styled their arguments, they know that this commission doesn't have jurisdiction over the members. The questions the non-members, and I'm going to tell you, you're going to be much better off waiting to address those non-member issues when you have a set of facts, specific facts, to make that line in the sand. So many people would say the tribal jurisdiction overlay with the state and federal law can be confusing, perhaps even messy, but it is the law, and Native American Telecom is appropriate in its approach in dealing directly with the tribe in offering services on the reservation. And short of that, I would entertain any questions of the commission, any specific questions.
Thank you, Mr. Wazorek. Commissioner Advisor, questions?
I don't so much have a question. I think I understand the subject matter. Why don't you go ahead and ask your question, Mr. Smith? Or Commissioner Johnson? But Hanson. I keep calling you Johnson, Hanson, Nelson.
Well, we look so much alike.
Johnson, Johnson, Hanson, Nelson.
There's a story I can tell about that, but Commissioner Johnson doesn't want to hear it right now, so. This is really intriguing, the way everything fits or it doesn't fit together. I've always looked at the nine tribes, tribal reservations, as being sovereign nations, and that the chair people are chairmen or chair persons are heads of state. And I recognize the validity of your arguments that what is on the reservation is basically it's not something that the Public Utilities Commission can regulate to that extent. I accept the argument that the relationship between the tribe and a tribal member on reservation should be, I accept your argument. The challenge comes where this now has been brought to the Public Utilities Commission. I still haven't reached a conclusion on it, but it's somewhat like bringing a bill to the legislature. Once the legislature's dealing with it and it's in committee or whatever, certainly the legislators give the legislators the right to withdraw their legislation, but they don't have to. You know, once it's in their committee, it's their bill. So I wrestle with it from that perspective. It's before the South Dakota PUC now. What do we do with it? It's not so much that, and from a precedent standpoint, it seems like we allow people to, you know, if they want to withdraw they can. So that's my challenge right now as to whether or not the ownership is here before the PUC. I'm inclined, just because the petitioner wants to withdraw it, that they should be allowed to do that. The other areas in the arena of the argument can be dealt with at a different time, but I just wanted to voice that opinion so that if anyone can convince me otherwise or help me ferret that out, they can, because I'm inclined to allow the petitioner to withdraw their petition when they want to do that, but at the same time I think that it's now in the lap of the PUC, so it's regardless of whether my belief is that reservations are sovereign and have the rights, as you say, whether or not that supersedes what our rights and responsibilities are at this point. And I throw that out for your opportunity to comment on it. If there's something further you want to comment on. Other than that, I'd look to my colleagues for their thoughts.
If I may. Thank you. I have one for Ms. Kramer. Can you walk me through the 2010-124, where it's in your brief, where they can dismiss or withdraw prior to entry of a final order by the commission if a stipulated agreement is filed. Can you walk me through how that, if we don't have a stipulated agreement, how we get by that?
Yes, and what I said in my brief is there was substantial compliance, and by that I meant that, as Commissioner Hansen pointed out, we have had others dismiss their pleadings without the stipulated agreement. And we frequently dismiss and close without this formality. And so that's, while that's our rule, we don't hold everybody to that, to that degree. And so my point was, here's the rule, and there was substantial compliance here.
You know, Ms. Kramer, if I can add on, don't you think the final sentence in that is also instructive? The commission may, and I'm looking over your shoulder, my apologies, Commissioner, the commission may also dismiss a pleading at the request of an interested party or on its own motion, stating the reasons in its order. I mean, that's not quite as narrow as the first portion of that rule.
Correct. And what I assume others would argue is that the petitioner is not necessarily an interested party, and I would disagree with that. I believe all parties involved are interested parties. I don't know if I think others may argue that what that sentence means is of those outside of the petitioner. But that would not be how I would read that. I agree with you. I think that last sentence certainly allows dismissal.
Is interested party defined anywhere in those rules or in code? I don't recall so. I mean,
I don't know that it is. Party is defined, but I don't ever recall seeing interested party. But I can't say for sure that it's not.
Well, and for my two cents, Commissioner Colbeck, I mean, when I look at the first part of that, boy, it's really hard to argue, I mean, the stipulated agreement. I mean, whether we've done that in the past or not, that to me is a major hurdle, if not for that last sentence.
And I guess just I would agree with Tal that this is not the place. I consider this to be a COA agreement. You can't force someone to get a driver's license, and you can't write them a ticket until they speed or drive without a license. So I don't see this in the light that the interveners do as a jurisdictional battle. I consider it more as a COA battle. But I do struggle with their arguments. I do understand what they say, and I hope that that's not the way Native American Telephone or the tribe actually sees this as a jurisdictional answer to any questions that they may have. I simply see this Ms. Rogers pointed out, as a company who applied for COA, who wants to withdraw their application now. If anybody else has any comments, any other commissioners on the battle of jurisdiction that was brought up, I'd love to hear them. But, and Commissioner Hansen, you had great quotes on that too. But does anyone see this as a battle of a jurisdictional matter rather than a COA matter?
Well, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, but that's sort of the nut that's before us a little bit. Other questions for any parties? Interested parties?
I don't know how interested I am, but first of all, I guess my thought on that last sentence, to me it wouldn't make sense to construe that word interested party as limited to, to me that has to mean any party, because otherwise you'd have the ridiculous conclusion that the party that brings a pleading can't do anything about it, but everybody else can. I mean, that's just asinine, and it can't mean that, I don't think.
Reason why you're the odds-on favorite to be appointed to the Supreme Court, Mr. Smith.
But I guess my thought, and this thing to me, and again, Mr. Wozarek, I thought this was going to be a relatively easy deal today, especially once you were involved. But you know, it's dramatically complicated once you've stretched this from a Rule 41 type dismissal into, in effect, requesting that we move on to some level of substantive decision making here. And I guess what I want to know is, I mean, to me, it's the only the only result that happens if we have sort of, say, a Rule 41 dismissal. That's a dismissal without prejudice. It has no, I totally disagree with the ideas of it's a presumption or it's a this or it's a that. There is no presumption at all on any item on the merits if that is the kind of dismissal we're talking about.
With a GPS.
And you get my drift. And if it's not, if we're adjudicating merits, then that's a different thing here. But as I understood the original motion, and unfortunately in the give and take of the way people respond to what other people do, this got stretched over into, I think, an unfortunate argument over into substance. We've had people, I recall, and we've had other cases, other COAs before apps, where there have been very vigorous resistance by interveners. A good example is Level 3's attempt to do a virtual NXX setup in Beresford a few years ago, which was an obvious attempt to glom onto some cherry picking there. You know, and yet they requested to dismiss. We did. They requested to withdraw, case dismissed. We didn't go on and adjudicate the merits, nor did we. There was no presumption whatsoever that was an adjudication on the merits. So I guess maybe a clarification here, and maybe you want to think about that a little bit. I mean, if we're talking about a dismissal without prejudice, with no implications whatsoever as to the merits of the case, that's one thing. If we're talking about a decision here that we're adjudicating some level of merits involving jurisdiction or something else, to me that's another matter. And I guess could you clarify me what you're up to?
There is, I believe, Mr. Smith, you hit it right on the head. The original motion was fairly straightforward, fairly short. I guess my request to the commission, given what got filed afterwards, was look, I think we're entitled to withdraw in a without prejudice to any party position. This jurisdiction question comes up from the Arlex briefing. I thought everybody was basically in agreement when it dealt with members that jurisdiction falls to the tribe. I offered that up as a clarification position the commission can take. Kate, look, if you're dealing with tribal members, we're not going to get in the way, but if you go beyond that, you do it at your own risk, something along those lines. Kind of under a belief that, number one, it might prevent us from coming back here. But I think the simple motion was, in the beginning motion was, a request to allow us to withdraw. The jurisdictional kind of got all piled on there later, and I can't contest that staff's position, just allow the withdrawal and don't go any further, is an inappropriate thing to take. I suggested adding or clarifying on as to the commission as just a way to clarify it and maybe cut through some of the clutter and give some direction so we're not back here with the first time a tribal member signs up, because I think that's a done deal under all the federal case law.
Other questions?
Well, I guess, Mr. Coit raised one point, and that was with respect to Section 4 of Chapter 13 and that the commission's ability to investigate and do all that. I guess my concern, and maybe it's for Mr. Coit and Ms. Rogers, but maybe y'all want to comment on this. I mean, there's a lot of powers the commission has. We have those investigative powers under Chapter 31 as well, and general supervisory powers. I guess the thing that bothers me about that kind of thing here is there's only one prayer for relief as of right now in this proceeding, and that's that a certificate of authority be granted. There's no other pleading in the case that asks for anything. And I guess my bottom line is, let's say we proceed with the COA app and interveners are totally successful as of the way the pleadings stand right now. Guess what? The app is denied. They don't have a COA. Well, then we're the same place we're going to be if we dismiss this thing today without prejudice. They don't have a COA. And any future actions the commission may want to take with respect to investigating what Native American may or may not be doing, or proceeding on to all those other issues that aren't involved with the prayer for relief before us today, you know, it just hits me that in the law, you do that when you have a pleading before you that puts parties on notice as to what the case is about and requests relief that tells us what it is before us that we're supposed to be deciding. And we don't have that here. We have an application for a COA. Maybe you could address that.
Well, I guess the concern that I have here is I think I'm not clear whether they intend to provide service to just tribal members and or non-tribal members. But we certainly have some facts. They're not proven. We haven't gone to hearing, but we have some alleged facts in their application for certification. I mean, the commission issues orders to show cause all the time. At what point would you, as the commission, determine that the facts were sufficient for you to go out and tell a company that was maybe a month from providing service that they needed to come in and show us why they shouldn't be applying for a certification in advance of providing service in accord with the provisions that say they're supposed to file at least 60 days in advance of providing service? I mean, the problem that I'm having with this is we seem to be ignoring some facts that are alleged by them in their application. They have every intention of providing basic telephone services, and there's nothing that says that they're going to limit that service to tribal members. And if they're not, aren't you concerned about them going in and commencing service without first getting your authority?
Well, whether I'm concerned about it or the commissioners are concerned about it or not, isn't a proceeding like that, in other words, an enforcement proceeding, normally commenced? Doesn't it usually come into existence via a pleading that tells the parties what they're accused of doing and puts everybody on notice as to what that proceeding is about?
I can understand that. I guess what the point is this process the appropriate process? I suppose you can make plenty of arguments that it's not. But what is the process going to be? Is it going to be expected that we wait around until they commence providing service to non-tribal members and then we file a complaint? Is that the process? Or is the commission going to issue an order to show cause when they commence providing service to a non-tribal member? What's the process going to be?
Other questions? Hearing none, I would move that the commission dismiss the docket without prejudice, dismiss the COA request without prejudice. I'll open the floor up for discussion.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I found the discussion helpful, and it's quite interesting, quite intriguing situation. Certainly the decision that we make here and with that motion should not be there should not be an assumption that the commission's position is that we have no interest of what is taking place on the reservation, and that there would be, as has been explained here, the potential for ferreting out those questions that regarding COAs or whatever, if in fact the events take place that would cause it to come before us. So I certainly appreciate the motion and I support it.
I would think that the process, as Mr. Coit had said, would be either of those two. Either we would, if we had the information, we would start the proceedings, or if they had the information, they could start the proceedings. Either one, I feel, would be sufficient. But I do struggle with a COA application going to that level. I don't think that it's the proper arena. I don't think this is the place to argue jurisdiction or other. As I said earlier, you can't write someone a speeding ticket assuming that they're going to speed after they get onto the interstate. We kind of have to know if they did violate the restrictions. So seeing this without prejudice, their docket, I would support your motion also.
Well, and I'd take just a slightly different slice. I mean, I do think that if the petitioner wanted to move forward and get a COA, we would have a very robust discussion about all of these types of issues. And, I mean, I do think, you know, COA proceedings can be very, very involved. But the petitioner doesn't want to move forward. And I think they're really too, you know, because we've got, do you dismiss the docket without prejudice? And then I think both parties, I mean, even Mr. Wazorek had said, well, dismiss, but also sort of make this declaratory ruling. And, you know, others want us to sort of move forward on the COA so that we can maybe make a declaratory ruling or the functional equivalent of that that would say something very different than what Mr. Wazorek would probably want us to say. Well, why does my motion only deal with one and not the other? And I think there are probably two reasons. I mean, the first is I think regulatory agencies really risk inappropriately overstepping when they render decisions broader than they need to be, number one. The second reason I don't want us to weigh in on those jurisdictional issues at this point is that I'm not crazy. I mean, I just think with relatively short briefs and with just the oral arguments we've had today, there's no way I'm wading into these jurisdictional issues, or no reason I want us to. I mean, I just think if we really get to having to make those decisions, the briefs are going to be a whole lot longer, and the arguments are, unfortunately, probably going to be a whole lot longer. So that's why I just wanted to deal with just sort of the simple approach.
And I just want to be on record and mm-hmm. kind of ask you the question that your motion deals absolutely nothing with jurisdictional issues.
It's completely silent on it.
Okay.
And I'm really excited about that fact.
All right.
Any further discussion on the motion? Yes.
Did you say without prejudice?
Yes, I did. And I'd just add near ever to that, I mean, to Mr. Coit and Ms. Rogers' concerns, I really don't think we're finding anything here. I think the issues you raised are very legitimate. They are those concerns have found good purchase in my mind. I'm just not sure this is the place to adjudicate those concerns at this point. Other discussion on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Just as a housekeeping matter, we've got that motion to compel. Does that just automatically go away with the dismissal?
If the case is dismissed, there's not a current proceeding for
sure.
It to be. Oh, there is?
There's a second docket, but that's a whole different matter.
Yeah.
And that can be dealt with next
time. I don't think that's on the agenda for today for decision. Yeah, no, yeah.
My question is specific with this docket. Does the motion to compel automatically go away because of the action we just took, or is additional action by the commission required?
It automatically goes away because the case is over.
Sure, gotcha. Perfect, thanks. All right, telecom number 4. Is a petition for arbitration of an interconnection agreement with Alltel Communications. It was filed by Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe Telephone Authority. The question for the commission today is, shall it approve the proposed procedural schedule? Do the parties wish to speak to the procedural schedule?
This is Karen Kramer from staff, and I can take care of that. The parties filed a joint proposal for a procedural schedule back in December. I failed to put it on the next agenda, so it's on this agenda. In the meantime, they have changed 3 dates. On paragraph 2, that will become January 25th rather than January 15. Paragraph 3 becomes February 9 rather than January 29. And February 13 becomes February 23rd. And with that, staff would recommend approving the procedural schedule as set forth.
Thanks. Any questions? Hearing none, any discussion or action? I will move that the commission approve the proposed procedural schedule. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Telecom number 5 is a request for an approval of certain documents for the Fiber Ring Revenue Pooling Association. And the question for the commission today is simply, shall it approve those amended documents?
And I hate to interrupt at this time, Mr. Chairman, but this involves confidential materials and a variety of things, and I suspect if you have questions, and I do know we have a number of people on the phone, if you would want to move that to the end.
I think it's an excellent idea, and I know we've got some people on the line, or I think we do, from 321 Communications. They probably would have liked it if we would have done that with a couple other dockets, too. That's my apologies. Normally there's better meeting management than that. Number six, TC08-140, deals with the filing for an approval of an amendment to an interconnection agreement, which is between Quest and Verizon. Question for the commission today is, shall it approve that amendment? Staff.
This is Kara Semler for staff. The amendment was properly filed and executed. It does not appear to contain discriminatory language. No comments were filed. Staff recommends approval.
Thanks. Any questions? Hearing none, any discussion or action?
Motion in TC08-140 that the commission approve the amendment to the interconnection agreement.
Motion has been made. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. The motion carries 3-0. Telecom 7 is TC08-141, and this is a request of 321 Communications for a local exchange COA. The question today is, shall the commission grant that COA? We'll look first to 321 Communications.
I'm here if you would like.
Yeah, Mr. Jones, Mr. Salt.
Okay, Mr. Salt, Mr. Jones had another meeting he had to attend, so I'm going to do my level best.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, with 321 Communications, we are a we would like to have the ability to do origination and termination in the state of South Dakota, and it's very straightforward, very simple, and we've submitted all of our information to staff, and we just would like to get a ruling so we can move forward.
Thank you very much. We'll look to staff, Ms. LaBrie-Baker, Ms. Kramer.
Thank you, Commissioner. This is Terry LaBrie-Baker with staff. On December 19th, 321 Communications filed its application for a certificate of authority to provide local exchange service in the state of South Dakota. They've requested a waiver from ARSD 2010-320312 as it applies to providing the cash flow statement. They've also agreed to the restrictions from providing prepaid services, including prepaid calling cards, and from accepting deposits and advance payments. They filed according to our administrative rules, and staff would recommend that the commission grant the waiver and approve a COA with the restrictions mentioned and subject to rule safeguards.
Questions for parties? Ms. LaBrie-Baker, you mentioned rural safeguards. The I don't know, there was some wording, I think, in the COA that I have in front of me that was maybe a little more vague than that. You know, a lot of times people will mention specifically Quest territory. I think they sort of talked around that issue a little bit. I presume the condition with rural safeguards takes care of that. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay, great. Other questions? Hearing none, any action? I would move the commission grant the COA with the restrictions and recommendations suggested by staff. Any discussion on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much, and our apologies for the delay.
No, thank you very kindly. Enjoy your evening.
A little different definition of regulatory lag, maybe, than we're accustomed to.
All right, you guys take it. Thank you very much.
Yep. Telecom item number 8 is TC09-001. This is a request by AT&T Communications for approval of revisions to a tariff. Today, shall the commission grant the withdrawal request and close the docket? Look first, AT, if anyone from AT&T Communications of the Midwest is on the line or here in Pierre. Hearing none or seeing none, we'll look to Mr. Thurber and Ms. Kramer.
Thank you, Chairman. AT&T has requested to withdraw the tariff filing because the effective date did not allow for a 30-day notice period. The company plans on refiling the tariff in the near future. Staff recommends granting the withdrawal.
Any questions? Hearing none, any action?
No, just motion in TC09-001 that the commission grant the withdrawal request and close the docket.
Motion has been made. Hearing no discussion, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. The motion carries 3-0. With that, we come to telecom item number 5, and again, this deals with the amended documents from FERPA. FERPA, any comments on the filing?
My name is Darla Rogers, and I represent FERPA.
Ms. Rogers, I'm sorry to interrupt, but just another reminder to everybody, if there is any information disclosed that you want to remain confidential, let us know. We can clear the phone lines and the room. Thanks.
What I would like to do is just, if I may, give you a very brief background. I know the hour is late, and then perhaps open it up to questions. I do have our consultants, Vantage Point Solutions, I hope are still on the line, and I would defer to them for any substantive or cost questions. FERPA actually was organized many years ago as a pooling arrangement to coordinate the construction and provide a centralized administration system of ring facilities across the state of South Dakota. Since our initial grant of authority to proceed, we've actually tried not to burden this commission with coming back again and again and again. We did come before the commission in 2000, and we asked for approval of some changes that we made to the agreements at that time. We did file new agreements, and they were approved by the commission. Then again in 2005, we came back before this commission and asked for approval of new agreements. And we're back now, this time, because the agreements that you approved in 2005 expired or were set to expire on December 31 of 2008. So these are basically short-term agreements. And we have made changes to the agreements for a couple of reasons. And the reason what we're seeking today is your approval of those revised contracts. The revised contracts extend the terms of the SRP and RUL contracts, and they also include revisions to recognize recent network upgrades. I would tell you that there have been significant FERPA network upgrades to resolve concerns with aging fiber and aging electronics, depreciated network capacity issues, latency issues, all related to the routes of the network. In addition, as you are aware, SDN signed an agreement with the state of South Dakota with regard to the Reed network, and so the other changes that we made in these particular contracts was to revise the term to more closely align with the agreement that SDN has with the state. We submitted copies of the amended contracts and other items for your consideration. I did state in our petition that there are 29 LECs who currently participate in FERPA as an RUL or an SRP or both. And that is a true representation. I will tell you that there is one company with whom we have not quite negotiated final language to the agreement, so they are still participants both as an SRP and an RUL, but it would be under the old agreements pending our resolution of some issues that we're working through with that company. Otherwise, I believe everything we've stated in the petition is correct. We've had a meeting with staff, tried to answer any questions that have come up, and at this time we are requesting you, this commission, to approve the revised agreements that we've submitted.
Thank you, Ms. Rogers. Staff.
Thank you, Commissioner. One second, but I was just told by Damaris here that because of the fact that the state operator is gone, she has no way of knowing, of verifying who's on or off the phone, so I'm just going to let you know that with respect to confidential information, we may have to take a few extra precautions. Sorry to interrupt.
No, I'll try not to talk about confidential information. So, as Ms. Rogers stated, staff has, met with the FERPA representatives. We submitted a couple of data requests. They responded to it. And essentially, the main changes from when you approved these agreements in 2005 is the PNS rate, which goes through the switch access cost study, was lowered effective, I believe it was June 1st of 2007. And the other change was the capacity assessment, which would be Exhibit F to the agreements, replaces the prior discretionary capacity use. And that's only applicable to SDN. Essentially, SDN you know, is purchasing excess capacity. When Starla talked about the REED project, those expenses are assessed, you know, are allocated to SDN, and that rate reflects that. And so staff would recommend approval of the agreements effective as of January 1st, 2009, and that approval in this docket does not preclude the commission from making any adjustment in the individual switched access cost studies related to FERPA, revenues, expenses, or plant. And if you have any questions, I'll try to answer those without getting any confidential information.
Could you reiterate once more, Mr. Cannell, your conclusion, your recommendation?
Okay. Staff would recommend approval of the agreements effective as of January 1st, 2009, and that approval in this docket does not preclude the commission from making any adjustment in the individual switched access cost studies related to FERPAs, revenues, expenses, or plant.
Perfect. Thanks very much. Questions for any party? I'll take one for staff. Mr. Canale, I think it was it staff that filed the data request?
Staff asked the questions, and FERPA requested that it be put into the docket.
Okay.
We were requested to confidentially file the responses so that you would have the information as commissioners prior to this docket. We thought that might be helpful, and so we complied with that request.
Yeah, I did find it helpful generally. I mean, it's not typical, I guess, nor is it unusual for, you know, data for discovery to be filed in such a manner. Was there something in particular, and I know it was filed confidential, but was there something in particular that either party wanted the commissioners to pay attention to? I mean, I found it helpful. I want to make sure I didn't miss anything.
No, you probably didn't. It was really more at my request. When I read through the response, I just found it more enlightening, and so I thought, well, in case you had any of those same questions or concerns that Mr. Knadel and Ms. Liberty Baker had, it would cut to the chase a little bit, and that's all that was.
But there wasn't a particular red flag that a commissioner was to pick up on?
No,
okay.
None.
I mean, I did find it helpful.
Also, I think is most of these agreements, they're confidential agreements, and so a lot of the questions that we ask related to the agreements, and so, I mean, we thought it'd be helpful for the commission to, you know, see those questions and responses without closing, you know, the hearing in this matter, so to speak. It may speed up the process a little bit.
Other questions? Hearing none, any discussion or action? I'd be happy to move that the commission approve the amended documents with the caveats outlined by staff, in particular that this isn't making any sort of a predetermination on the commission on how on treatment for a switched access rate case or any other. So, any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Commissioner Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. There are some amendments at the end of our agenda, which we'll draw your attention to. And unless there's any further business to come before the commission, we will stand adjourned.